We can't mourn forever, okay? I mean, you look at it like this, okay? Ric Flair couldn't have become a 16-time champion without losing 15 times.
And that'll be Charlotte in a month.
Dashing through the snow in a one-horse open sleigh, o'er the fields we go, laughing all the way. Woo! The bells on bobtail ring, they make our spirits bright. What fun it is to ride and sing a sleighing song tonight.
Woo!
Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh.
Woo!
Do you believe that Big E supposedly got heat for that comment that you just heard there from Monday night? That's the rumor making the rounds. It was an improvised line, and people backstage were none too happy about it. It's no wonder people are so afraid of their own shadow there. This is the Christmas/Hanukkah show for 2016. Solid Monster Sounds Off, episode 475. Here for Sunday, December 25th, 2016. I am the Solemn Monster. How about that? Hanukkah and Christmas, they coincide this year. And so to those who celebrate, I say Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Kwanzaa. I'm always trying to keep track of all these holidays. They all fall around the same time. So hopefully whatever you are doing, wherever you are today, you are spending time either with family or friends or doing whatever makes you happy. I'm doing this podcast, so this makes me happy. We have a lot to get to this week. This is not one of those, hey, it's a slow week, it's a holiday. This is going to be a packed show, because beyond the usual reviews and news and notes and mailbag questions, I have a list. My list, the list of Solid Monster. We're going to do the top 10 WWE matches of 2016, ranked from number 10 all the way down to number 1. And I'm going to be talking about some of the biggest events that took place in wrestling this year in 2016, kind of a year-in-review type thing. A lot of good stuff on tap, so hopefully you'll tag along for the ride here. First thing I want to mention up front, just to remind everybody, you can vote to nominate this podcast, Solid Monster Sounds Off, in the Wrestling Radio Awards for 2016. If you go on WrestlingRadioAwards.com, you will see several categories, and you have to write in your choice. Because this is the nomination process, they haven't actually picked the finalist yet. If you would like to nominate this show for Show of the Year, all you got to do is go to the website, scroll down, I think it might be the second line, you'll see Show of the Year. That's the category that would apply to us. Type in the full name of the show, Solid Monster Sounds Off, click Submit. Then you can go back to the form again, scroll down to the bottom, and you will see a category for Male Interview of the Year. And if you would be so kind as to write in Bob Holly on Solid Monster Sounds Off. I had the privilege, since we're talking about 2016 here, I had the privilege of interviewing a lot of really cool people this year, from Diamond Dallas Page twice to Booker T, Jim Ross, Katrina from Lucha Underground, Rob Van Dam, a whole bunch of people. I enjoyed all of them. But I think the interview with Bob Holly is the one that I interviewed or liked the most, I should say. It was also the longest one that I did, but it was such an easygoing conversation. And Bob's, you know, I've gotten to know Bob a little bit because we've talked even long before this online. And he was game for anything. And I thought he was very raw and very open and honest, I felt, about a lot of different subjects. And it's a pretty wide-ranging interview, talking about the wellness policy and steroids and some of the incidents that he's been involved in over the years. And a whole bunch of different things. And I really just was very happy with that interview. And the reaction I got to it was very, very much positive. So if you'd like to nominate that one for Male Interview of the Year, that's the place to do it. I don't know when the nomination period ends. It could be any day now. It could be another week or two. I have no idea. But in the meantime, just keep voting once a day in each category. Every single day you can vote. And I would very much appreciate that. Also, thank you to everybody who's been taking advantage of our Audible offer. We're one more sign up away from kind of a nice even number of trials generated for the year. It's kind of gnawing away at me. I just need one more. So anyway, if you've been waiting, this is a great time to take advantage of it. You can get yourself a free audiobook. Audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Sign up. You get yourself a free 30-day trial of the service. And in doing so, you can cash in one free audiobook that you get to keep no matter what. Even if you cancel your trial and are never billed, you get to keep that book. The Death of WCW has been a popular audiobook option of late, but there's a whole bunch of books you can pick. So go ahead and take advantage of that with our link. And I want to also just say thank you to everybody who donated, our PayPal VIPs. You can always make a donation on thesolomonster.com. PayPal button is on the right-hand side of the page. I'm going to do a handful of shout-outs, because I got a bunch of them this week, and this is enough house cleaning, I think, for the beginning. I want to get right into it. So I'm going to break these shout-outs up. If you did donate this week and you don't hear your name right now, just keep listening, because what I've done is I've kind of sprinkled donations throughout the entire show. So for the rest of the podcast here and there, I'll be doing some shout-outs. But up front here, I'd like to say thank you to John Loose Cannon Lopez. John has donated, I'm pretty sure, every week this year. He is a loyal, very dedicated fan of the show. Called in, I know, when we had our call-in show from the Sirius Studios SummerSlam weekend. He's a really good guy. I want to say thank you on the air here to him. Deadpool James Herrera, another longtime loyal listener. Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Nemesis Nathan Moyers, Out of Control Cody Thomas, and Malicious Intent Michael Cuomo. Thank you guys very much. Again, we'll do more of those as the show goes along. Our fourth annual Royal Rumble pool. Can you believe this? It really doesn't feel like all that long ago that we did the third one, and here we are coming up on the fourth one. Our Royal Rumble pool on Facebook. This has become an annual tradition now in our Facebook private group, which you need to apply for membership. It is now underway, and it will be underway for the next several weeks. There's no, you know, fast approaching deadline, so don't worry about that. If you want details on how to join our Royal Rumble pool, I am going to save that for the end of this week's podcast. I usually buy a sound-off shirt for the winner to send to them, give them a shout-out here on the podcast. It's just a fun, cool thing for people to be part of. I've been a part of it the last 3 years. I've never won. I'm hoping this year my luck will change, but who knows. So listen until the end of the show this week if you want some more information on that. Roadblock. There was a pay-per-view last weekend. Of course, there's, you know, I would be willing to bet that if you took any given random weekend and said, I bet there was a pay-per-view this weekend, more often than not, you would be right. That's how many shows there are. But Roadblock was last weekend. Threw up a poll on Twitter. Over 2,300 of you voted. 34% thumbs up, 68% thumbs down. Not one of the better shows this year, but I did love the end of that tag team title match. I just thought it was a super creative finish. I mean, just when you think you've seen every possible finish to a pro wrestling match, when you see one that you really don't ever remember seeing before, it's pretty cool. Because it's hard. I mean, in wrestling, whether it's moves or finishes or you know, gimmicks or whatever it may be, it's tough to be creative and original because it feels like everybody's done everything or you've seen every iteration of a move. And so anyway, just a minor thing, but I thought that was very clever. If you want my full thoughts on the show, I have a full, I think roughly half hour long review of Roadblock. It's up on the YouTube channel as a sound off extra. You can always download the MP3 if you go into the video description for those of you who keep asking me. So head on over to YouTube to check out my full thoughts on that. And now what I want to start with here, I mentioned at the top of the show, this is our final podcast of 2016. The next time that you are listening to a sound off, it will be the first show of the new year. And so here to kind of look back and commemorate 2016, I thought, why don't we do a countdown? People love countdowns. They love lists of the top 10 WWE matches for 2016, and there have been a lot of great ones, and this list does not just include WWE main roster. This is Raw, this is SmackDown, this is NXT, and this is the Cruiserweight Classic. And for all the faults that we can find with the product this year, Raw, there was a lot of great wrestling. That's the one thing you really can't say in terms of just matches. There have been a shit ton of great matches this year in WWE, and so this was not the easiest list in the world to put together. I mean, there were some things, you know, some matches on this list that were a given. Where they would rank, though, is the question. So I've gone through the trouble of ranking them. This is just a very subjective list. Your list may be different than mine. But I do think that a lot of you probably will agree with many of the matches that are on here. So let's get right into it here. I did mention that the Cruiserweight Classic, I consider that to be part of this list. And number 10 in the countdown is a quarterfinal match from the Cruiserweight Classic tournament between Kota Ibushi and Brian Kendrick. This will not be the only time that you hear Kota Ibushi's name mentioned in this countdown. Just be aware of that. He was a superstar in every sense of the word in this thing. I'm not going to say, well, he saved the tournament or anything, because there was a lot of great talent in the tournament. But when this guy was out there, there was no one better than him. Kota Ibushi came into this thing with a big name, a big profile, a lot of hype around him, and he delivered every single time he stepped in that ring. I don't think I've seen a bad Kota Ibushi match. And it didn't matter who you put him in the ring with. That was kind of the thing that impressed me the most. He worked well with all of them, and I'm not sure he ever had a match before this with Brian Kendrick. I'm not sure he ever had a match before this with, you know, TJ Perkins or Cedric Alexander. And so the fact that this guy, who I don't know that he speaks any English at all. If he does, it's very little. And so communication is always an important thing. For him to go in there and to put on a show the way that he did, I know that there was one, and it actually might have been this match, to be fair, where apparently there was some kind of a botch where I think Ibushi was outside the ring. And, you know, in Japan, it's a 20 count, not a 10 count like it is here in the States. And I think he may have gotten himself counted out, and they kind of edited that off the show. I think it might have been this match here with Kendrick, but I'm not 100% sure about that. But I'm going by what I saw. I'm going by what they aired on TV. And this was a really, really good match. I mean, I thought the story they told was great with Kendrick's. This was his last chance. Like, now Brian Kendrick's a heel. He's the cocky, arrogant SOB on TV. But when he came into the Cruiserweight Classic, he was a babyface in every sense of the word. And the story that they were telling was Kendrick is a little bit older now. He's in his late 30s, and he made some mistakes in his career, got fired from WWE, and he's getting a second chance. This is his chance to win the Cruiserweight Classic and to get back into the good graces of WWE. And Daniel Bryan, who's been good friends with him going back, because they came up in the business together. In fact, I think they both had their first pro match against one another. And Daniel Bryan was on commentary for this tournament with Mauro Ranallo. And Daniel Bryan, who, and I'm sure that they were channeling their real emotions here, he was rooting for Brian Kendrick. He wasn't even trying to mask how biased he was. He wanted to see his friend win. And it played into the story that they were telling that he had to win. If he didn't win, it was going to be all over for him. And, you know, in this match in particular, you know, his move is the bully choke. Now they call it the captain's hook. There were a bunch of bully choke attempts. He had finished off some guys with it, so they had established this as a move that you don't want to find yourself in. A lot of bully choke attempts in this match, including Ibushi. There was a great spot towards the end of the match where Ibushi went for a Phoenix Splash. He crashed and burned, landed face first on the mat, and as soon as he splatted on the mat, Kendrick just caught him in the bully choke and wrenched back, and you had people in the crowd, and myself included for a moment there, who thought, oh shit, like, are they actually going to put Brian Kendrick over this guy? Like, you knew going into this tournament that Ibushi was not losing to Brian Kendrick, but in that moment, all of a sudden, it's like, whoa, wait a minute here. You know, like, what is, because you knew, like, Ibushi didn't sign, are they actually going to have him lose here in this match? And I think it created some great drama. I think the thing that people will remember most about this match, and I certainly will remember this most about this match, was the Burning Hammer spot. Burning Hammer is not a move that you see really at all in WWE, and if you saw the one here, you can see why. Burning Hammer, basically, he gets Ibushi up on his shoulders, almost in a torture rack position, and then just dumps him right on his friggin' head. I mean, and they told the story here of Ibushi, who had just, he had come off major neck surgery not that long ago. He was out for quite a while. There was talk that he was going to retire. He was going to start some kind of wrestling institute. He was being very weird with the things that he was saying. All of a sudden, he shows up here in the Cruiserweight Classic, and he looks like he never missed a beat. But they told the story of, here's a guy who had major neck surgery. and Kendrick is working over the neck all throughout the match, and then finally he drops him on the back of his neck with the burning hammer. And there were people in the crowd, Brian on commentary, everybody lost their shit. It was a close near fall. He did kick out, but it was good for a near fall. But again, they told that story. There were a lot of intertwining stories they told in this entire tournament. In this match, there were a couple of them right there. Ibushi, you know, found a way to survive. He wins with the Golden Star Powerbomb to advance in the tournament. After the match, Daniel Bryan, tears in his eyes, leaves the commentary booth. He gets into the ring. He embraces Kendrick. You know, the emotion felt real because it was real, right? The story wasn't. It was kind of ridiculous to think that, you know, after a performance like this, WWE would not sign Bryan Kendrick to some kind of a contract. I don't know that I really bought into the whole last chance thing, but that was the story they were telling. But again, the stuff between Daniel Bryan and Bryan Kendrick was real. The emotion was real. The tears were real. I think Bryan was just genuinely happy for his friend. And to see these two guys, you know, bawling their eyes out in the middle of the ring, it was cool. You know, it was a cool sight to see. And Bryan Kendrick did not come out of this match a loser at all. You know, he was getting a standing ovation. He had a great showing for himself in this tournament. And, you know, it just... I think the whole thing with the real emotion, I just think it's something that is sorely lacking from what we see on the main roster today. We don't see enough of that. You can't have real emotion in every single thing that you do, but I definitely think what we see on TV, what we see on Raw in particular, could really benefit from having some real emotion and reality injected into it. We actually saw a little bit of that on SmackDown this week. Which I'm going to talk about a little bit later, and it got people buzzing, right? So there is something to be said, I think, for injecting some realism into the shows. Number 9 on the countdown was a fatal four-way for the Intercontinental Championship at Extreme Rules back in May, with The Miz defending against Kevin Owens, Sami Zayn, and Cesaro, May 22nd, to be exact. The thing about fatal four-ways, they could be a cluster. More often than not, you never really know what you're going to get. Depends on who's in it. In this case, you had three excellent workers and The Miz, which sounds like an insult, but I mean, it's not taking anything away from what Miz brings to the table. I think Miz has been one of the best heels in the company all year, right behind Charlotte. I think he has really upped his game after all these years in WWE, and you're kind of tired, it's The Miz. He's having one of his best years. In maybe ever, if not in a number of years. But clearly, I think it's safe to say The Miz, as far as being an in-ring worker, does not have the same level of experience or, is not the kind of, like, mat technician that the other guys are. He doesn't have all these flashy moves. He doesn't fly all over the place and do stuff like that. He can't do a lot of the things that a Cesaro can do, because Cesaro's a freaking beast. There aren't very many people that can do what Cesaro does. And Zayn and Owens, they've been wrestling since they were friggin' teenagers, you know, wrestling each other in Canada, going back a number of years, 15 years or something like that. So, you know, if you had to rank these guys in terms of that, Miz is going to be at the bottom of the list. But I think Miz served his role well. He didn't feel out of place. He didn't bring the match down or anything like that. I thought he impressed me here. And like I said, he's been impressing me now for a number of months. But the chemistry that these four guys had, I just made for a four-star match. And the finish was so great for a few reasons. First, Miz got dumped to the floor. Zayn hit Cesaro with the Huluva kick, seemingly had the match won. Kevin Owens reaches in, he drags Sami Zayn out of the ring at the last second. And so these two guys are now brawling outside the ring. Their hatred for one another is such that Kevin Owens basically was like, if I can't win this, then you can't either. And it ended up costing both of them the championship, and so this allowed Miz to sneak back inside, steal the pin, and he retains the championship. I thought it was a great heel move. It was a finish that made sense. This is a match that I think would be very easy for some people to forget. It was just a, you know, kind of a random four-way on a pay-per-view, but it's a match that is worth going back and watching, and if you never saw it before, go ahead and check it out. I think it's well worth your time. Number 8. In the countdown, Kota Ibushi, there's that name again, against TJ Perkins in the semifinals of the Cruiserweight Classic. This is where it all came to an end in the tournament for Kota Ibushi, but he went out with three straight classics in this tournament. And the only reason he didn't win, I have no doubt. I mean, who the hell knows, right? But I have no doubt in my mind, the only reason he did not win this entire thing is because he refused to sign a contract. He is perfectly content to come in when they need him and do a shot here and there. He's even worked one or two house shows for the NXT brand. I think he worked one out in California. But he's not willing to sign a full-time deal and to leave Japan behind. And credit to him. You know, he's got goals. He wants to wrestle for New Japan. And he I think he may even be on the Wrestle Kingdom show coming up in about a week or so. I'm not sure. But because he wouldn't sign a contract, I kind of see where they're coming from. It doesn't make sense to put a guy over that you can't control. Otherwise, he would have won the whole damn thing. So, and also, had he signed, I think 205 Live would be a hell of a lot better off for it. But poor TJ Perkins here. You know, I think TJ Perkins looked awesome in this tournament, and I don't think he's looked as good since. And I don't know if that's a reflection on them telling him not to do some, you know, certain things, or just the way the cruiserweights are booked, or them giving cruiserweights sometimes 5 or 6 or 7 minutes instead of the 10, 12, 15 minutes that these guys had. I don't know. I can't really pinpoint what it is. TJ Perkins is still a great wrestler. But, you know, TJ and some of these other guys, we saw sides of them in this tournament that I still think we haven't seen on the main roster. For whatever reason. And maybe I'm the only one who feels that way. But, you know, watching back some of these matches, it's like, wow. Like, where's that guy, you know? But poor Perkins, to me, he got booed by a pretty decent number of people after each match on that final show, because he had two matches on that show. One was against Ibushi, the other one was in the finals against Grand Metalik. And, yeah, he had people cheering for him, but there was a vocal minority of people who were booing him. And whether that was just the fact that they don't like him, they think he's, they don't like the dabbing, or they just were big fans of Ibushi and Metalik, I can't answer that. But he certainly has not had matches this good since this tournament ended. So maybe they are telling these guys to slow it down, I don't know. But Perkins won with a knee bar in a match that had people on the edge of their seat. When he tapped out, you could feel the energy kind of sucked out of the crowd in the building, the feeling of shock that came over people when Ibushi tapped out. They were stunned, and not in a very happy way, but that's just the way it had to be. Doesn't take away from the fact, though, that this was a fantastic match. Number 7, Roman Reigns and AJ Styles for the WWE World Championship at Extreme Rules back on May 22nd. These two guys had a great match the month before at Payback, but this one gets the nod because the thing I wasn't really a big fan of the first match they had at Payback was the start and stop. They did that twice, where the match ended on a countout, AJ wins, then Shane McMahon comes out, gets the big pop. No, this is the new era, we're not going to end a match like this. Restart the match, no countout. And at that point, you kind of know, all right, when is the DQ coming? When is Stephanie walking out? And sure enough, right, AJ wins again by DQ because of an accidental nut shot by Roman. And out comes Stephanie McMahon. Oh no disqualification. It was just, I don't know. It kind of killed the momentum of the match a little bit. So I like this one better. This match was nonstop action from start to finish. Styles bumped his ass off in this match. Roman, I thought, more than held up his end. We also got run-ins again, second month in a row from the club and the Usos. Styles, at one point, went absolutely ballistic with a steel chair. He was beating the shit out of everybody with the chair. These were not light chair shots either. He was going to town on these guys. In the end, though, the big dog pulls it out, and Seth Rollins made his big return from knee surgery after the match. You know, watching this back, I watched this on the way home from work the other day. It really drove home what a mistake it was not to bring Rollins back as a babyface. In a way, it kind of makes sense bring him back as a heel because that's what he was when he left, but it was a mistake. It was definitely a mistake. And, you know, now he's a babyface and he's got a good number of fans, but it's not like Seth Rollins, the babyface, has been lighting the world on fire, and that could be for any number of reasons. It could be because people are tired of waiting after months and months and months for Triple H to come back and for them to keep that storyline going. Or it could just be that they missed their opportunity here. You know, they had something with this guy when he first came back. People were going nuts for him, and he went right back to being a heel. And I think hindsight being, I can't even say hindsight because, you know, me and a bunch of other people at the time were like, what are you doing? Why is this guy a heel? But they had their plans, and they didn't want to break away from those plans. Number six in the countdown, DIY and the Revival. NXT TakeOver Back to Brooklyn, August 20th. This was the first of two TakeOver matches that these two teams had this year. The chemistry between these two teams is just off the charts. I could watch them wrestle every week. Gargano and Ciampa can pretty much do it all. They can wrestle with you. They can fly, or at least Gargano can. They can do flashy stuff, but they don't rely on it. You know what I mean? The Revival, they're just a throwback to me. I look at them and I see Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard. I think Brainbusters. And that's not a bad comparison to make because the Brainbusters, although their time in WWE at least was kind of limited, they were a great tag team. And, you know, even as the Horsemen in the NWA, I don't know that they certainly were no worse. I mean, they were just a great team. And so I look at the Revival and that's what I think of. And, you know, they really worked over Gargano's leg in this match. It led to the finish with him being forced to tap out. And what I think was a knee bar, I think. I should know this. I'm pretty sure it was a knee bar. But this is important because it played into the story they told in the rematch a few months later. But this was just classic old school tag team wrestling here. And the fans ate it up. They ate up every minute of it. Which just goes to show you, you know, you don't need to reinvent the wheel to appeal to today's audience. I think if you give them a very well-worked pro wrestling match with good psychology and you have some personalities that they care about, the people love Gargano and Ciampa, so that helps. And you just let these guys work their magic, they're going to give you a great match every single time. And the people will respond to it. And they did here. And for me to be in the building, because I was there for that show, was really cool. To be there live and to be able to see these guys do their thing. So, thumbs up. This was a great match. Number five in the countdown. Getting to the second half here. Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn from Battleground on July 24th, the final pre-draft pay-per-view. We had seen a lot of matches before this between these two guys. None of them in WWE that I thought were as good as they could have been. I knew these two had it in them to go out and just tear the house down, and that's what they did here. They finally had their big, best match in WWE. They saved it for this show, and because they were building it around the idea that this is going to be it. You know, they could be drafted to different shows. I was shocked when they weren't. I really was. I thought for sure it was going to be one of them going to SmackDown. I'm still not quite sure why they had to stay on the same brand. But they were building it up as the climax of their feud. This could very well be the final time that you see these guys, at least for a very long time, going at it. And so they went out there and they had a blow-off match. That's exactly how they designed it, how they booked it, clearly. And it was awesome. It's not often two guys get a standing ovation in the middle of a match. While the match is still in progress, these two guys did. And deservedly so. And it was a great climax to the story they were telling. Obviously, the story between these two predates their runs in WWE. But, you know, even just going back to NXT, Kevin Owens debuts, right? They're best friends. The very night, in fact, that he debuted, he turns his back on Sami Zayn. He beats the hell out of him. Then he takes the championship away from him. He takes everything away from this guy. And then he gets called up before Sami does to the main roster. And this was Sami's chance at redemption here. And I love the finish with him hitting the Huluva kick. He doesn't immediately go for the pin. He kind of props up Owens. He doesn't let him fall to the mat. He just kind of stares at him, props him back up in the corner, hits him with the second Huluva kick, and then gets the pin, and he wins the match. This was supposed to be the final match. We all know the word final in wrestling has a very short shelf life, but this was a great match to blow off the feud, even though it was Kevin Owens who went on to win the championship. And Sami Zayn, think about this. So Kevin Owens loses this match. Sami Zayn gets the big win. Both of them tear the friggin' house down. And the very next month, Kevin Owens. Now, Kevin Owens lucked into it, you could say, because had Finn Balor not gotten hurt, there's no way Kevin Owens gets the championship, at least not when he does, maybe down the road. So yeah, Kevin Owens got a lucky break, but still, Kevin Owens is the one who ends up winning the this brand new Universal Championship. Now he's in main events. And Sami Zayn, who is, you know, 50% of this amazing match here, is, you know, toiling away with nothing to do for months. I mean, after a performance like this, the fact that Zayn was relegated to pre-show duty at SummerSlam is a slap in the face. Speaking of SummerSlam, that brings us to number four here in the countdown. John Cena and AJ Styles from SummerSlam back on August 21st. Their first meeting at Money in the Bank, they billed it as a dream match that we never thought we would see, and it lived up to expectations. This match, if that one lived up to expectations, I would say that this match blew those expectations away. And the sight of AJ Styles, for years, the face of TNA, coming into WWE at all, let alone in his first year then, beating John Cena clean in the middle of the ring at SummerSlam was unfathomable. A year ago, it would have been unfathomable. But that's what happened here. This was his second straight win over Cena. The first one was kind of marred. In fact, it wasn't kind of marred. It was marred. It was tainted by an assist from the club. Here, there was no assist. There was no hooking of the tights. There was no chair shot to the head or anything. You know, or anything. Well, I hope there was no chair shot to the head. None of that stuff. Tons of near falls. Tons of back and forth. Hitting big moves, kicking out. But in the end, AJ Styles outlasts Superman himself, John Cena. And his third win, he actually has three straight wins over John Cena this year. The third win would come the next month in No Mercy in that three-way that opened the show with Dean Ambrose. He didn't pin Ambrose, Styles pinned Cena in that match. But this SummerSlam match had everything. It had great action, it had great drama, a great crowd, which really made this thing feel special, felt like a big deal, and topped off with a shocking finish. Maybe it wasn't shocking to everybody, it was shocking to me. And I think the reason it was shocking to me is they actually did the right thing. Cena, we knew, was going to be taking some time off. AJ was the guy who was being built. SmackDown needed, they needed an A number one guy, and if it wasn't going to be Cena by default, it would have to be AJ Styles. No offense to Dean Ambrose, but he ain't no AJ Styles. So in a way, it's like, well, of course he would have won. It's just the natural outcome of the match. Cena was going away. If Cena wasn't going away, AJ wouldn't have won so clean. You know what? Maybe yes, maybe no. We'll never know the answer to that, but I was just happy that they actually did the right thing for a change. We've seen a lot of very screwy finishes lately in terms of the outcome that just makes you scratch your head and wonder what the hell are they doing. But here, for a change, they did the right thing. And it was great to see. And the people gave them, both of them, a standing ovation when the match was over. This was just great stuff. Great stuff. And I like this more than their Money in the Bank match. Number three, Kota Ibushi against Cedric Alexander in the second round of the Cruiserweight Classic. This is one of my absolute favorite matches of the year. My favorite of all the Ibushi matches in the Cruiserweight Classic, and the match that earned Cedric Alexander a WWE contract, which maybe he was going to get one anyway, but if there was any doubt, this was the match that sealed the deal. Hard-hitting kicks, each guy, you know, trying to outdo the other, and a fantastic series of near falls in the final 2 or 3 minutes of this match that had me convinced that Cedric had it won. Again, they managed to pull it off in a match where I probably should not have thought that Cedric Alexander would be beating Kota Ibushi for at least a few moments there. They got me to believe, and there was a brutal, brutal-looking brainbuster that got him a two count. He immediately sprang up and kicked Ibushi in the head, a wicked kick to the side of the head, and went for the pin again, and that to me was the best sequence of the whole match. Because the brainbuster had you thinking, oh boy, wait a minute here, that looked kind of nasty, this could be it. And when he kicked out, you didn't even have time to process the kick out before he kicked him in the head and went for another pin. And it's like, well, now this has got to be it. And again, he kicked out at the very last second. People were losing their minds. Cedric was almost in tears. He couldn't believe it. Daniel Bryan's going nuts on commentary. It was just fantastic. And in the end, Ibushi pulled it out. But, you know, Cedric, he earned so much more in losing that match than I think he would have had he won. This was a great example of how sometimes you can win by losing. The fans started a "Please sign Cedric" chant when the match was over. The guy is just in tears as he's going down the aisle to leave. He doesn't know if he'll ever be back. All of a sudden, out walks Triple H, right? Papa H comes walking out. He gives the thumbs up sign to the crowd like, "You want him signed? Okay, you got it." And he puts his arm around Cedric and he takes him to the back. One of the best endings to any wrestling TV show all year. Just great, great stuff. And to me, best match of that entire Cruiserweight Classic, which is saying a lot because I think the Cruiserweight Classic, just in terms of in-ring action, was probably, not even probably, it had to be the best tournament WWE has ever done and was the best show all year in WWE. More than NXT, more than Talking Smack, which I like. The best thing they produced all year was this Cruiserweight Classic. And this right here, in my opinion, was the best of the bunch. Number two. Getting to the final two here. Sami Zayn and Shinsuke Nakamura from NXT TakeOver Dallas on April 1st. This was from WrestleMania weekend. It's hard for me to find really any fault with this match other than maybe the fact that the outcome was pretty predictable. Everyone knew Zayn was finishing up at NXT that weekend. He was already booked on the WrestleMania card, you know, a day or two later. We all knew Nakamura was not losing in his debut. So you didn't really have any of that drama. Like, I just got done running through a list of you know, eight other matches here. And in a lot of those matches, including the one I just talked about with Ibushi and Cedric, I talked about drama. I talked about these near falls that had you thinking, oh, wait a minute, maybe this other guy's going to lose. I don't think you really had any of that in this match. Because you just look at it, and there's absolutely no way that Sami Zayn is beating this guy in this match. So it did take away, I think, a little bit of the drama, but that may be nitpicking. I mean, that's really the only criticism I can find of this match. This match otherwise had it all. It had everything else you could possibly want in a pro wrestling match. Being in the building that night, three rows deep, it was an incredible feeling to be there live for this. For Nakamura's entrance, I'll never forget that. You know, to be there for Nakamura's very first entrance with that music and the flashing lights, and it was quite a moment. And it had a big time feel. You know, the fans, they clearly knew who Nakamura was. They had seen his work in Japan. And, you know, the thing with Nakamura is, you know, for him, and I'll get into this more when I talk about some of the year in review stuff in a minute, but it's a big risk for him to come over, to leave all that behind and to come over and to try to create kind of like a brand new career for himself in a different country, in a different company. And he walked in here, and on his very first night, stole the show. In fact, stole the whole weekend. There was not a single match on that WrestleMania 32 card that was better than this. And kudos to both of these guys. It was a special match. They had the little moment there at the end. Sammy was... He looked despondent, but I'm sure he was also kind of proud. I'm sure he was sad, you know, that his NXT run was coming to an end. But the guy spent far longer than he should have in NXT. I mean, he was past his expiration point there, so he had to go. But he got the nice big standing ovation from the fans at the end and waved goodbye, and it was just a great moment. And that brings us to number one. What I believe, for me, is the number one best match in WWE on any brand all year long. It is the rematch between DIY and The Revival from NXT TakeOver Toronto on November 19th. This was a 2 out of 3 falls match for the NXT Championship, Tag Team Championship, that is. It was tough because, you know, I love number 2 and number 3 in this countdown, especially the Ibushi-Alexander match. But to me, when this match was over, when I got done watching this match and the music was still playing, I knew it was the match of the year. And that's without seeing TLC or Roadblock. I already knew. I said, this is going to be the match of the year in WWE. Nothing is going to top this. I went back and I watched it again a few days ago. It is every bit as great now as it was last month. This time, as I mentioned, it was 2 out of 3 falls. And a lot of times in WWE, when they'll bust out the 2 out of 3 fall stipulation, it's like, why even bother? Because they'll have the first fall in the first 2.5 minutes, and then the next person will get the next fall in the next 2.5 minutes, and then they'll wrestle a long match. And it's like, well, why don't you just have a friggin' long match? But here, you know, it was a while before the first team got the first fall, and they kind of built up drama to the second fall, which came several minutes later. They actually made use of the 2 out of 3 fall stipulation. the story they told in their last match of working over Johnny Gargano's knee came into play again here in this match, and it made for some great near falls. Now, why? Because they beat him with it the first time. They beat Gargano with that leg lock. They made him tap out, and so you thought, oh no, not again. But this time he managed to hang on, and he held on, he gutted it out, he grabbed the ropes. You know, Sasha Banks, she should have watched this match before her Iron Man match with Charlotte, and she might have been able to hang on those extra 2 seconds, and she would still be the champion right now. But again, great chemistry. You know, I assume this comes from working with each other night after night after night on those house shows down in Florida. This match was everything I love about pro wrestling here in these 30 minutes. The Revival mocking DIY, trying to use their own finish on them, and it backfired. And then later on, DIY using the Shatter Machine and only getting a near fall out of it. There was a spot here where the Revival revived, if you will, the old Heart Foundation heart attack finish for a near fall, which is not surprising because Scott Dawson is on record as saying Bret Hart is just his absolute favorite wrestler of all time. So clearly Scott Dawson has good taste. There was, again, the focus on Gargano's knee, drama down the stretch, both teams knotted up at one fall apiece. And then the finish was just outstanding. Gargano gets Wilder in the crossface, Dawson goes to break it up, but Ciampa cuts him off and puts him in the armbar. So now there's, you know, stereo submission attempts going on here. Dash and Dawson are down there looking at each other. They're facing each other on the mat, writhing in pain. They lock hands to try to make sure that neither one of them taps out, but the pain is too much to bear, and they each tap at the exact same time. And that crowd in Toronto, goddamn, that was a great crowd. You have never seen people so happy before. They would pan to the crowd, they show the reactions, and this was not one of, you know, this was not these manufactured crowd shots that, you know, Kevin Dunn now is obsessed with on all these pay-per-views, where people know now, hey, if I make a goofy face, I may be on TV. You know, this was real. This was real excitement from people who knew they just saw one of the best matches all year. They got the satisfying payoff that they did not get in Brooklyn, and they got it here in Toronto. And these two teams, look, these two teams may well have peaked with this match. I hope I'm wrong. I hope that one day they could do this at WrestleMania, but it really doesn't get any better than this. This was the match of the year in WWE. And that's a hell of a countdown. You got a lot of great matches on that list. I would urge you, if you have not already done so, or if there's a bunch you've never seen, I know some of you have just completely checked out on WWE. I can't say I blame you, but I just gave you a list of 10 awesome wrestling matches, so might not be a bad idea to start checking them out one by one. Since WWE is not doing a Slammy Award show this year, I would guess, I've gotten emails from people asking me, is there some sort of, you know, is there a reason why? And, you know, is there some kind of like a nefarious reason? I just assume that it's because of the brand split. And maybe they just didn't give it enough thought. They didn't have enough time to give it that much thought. And you can't really do the Slammies on Raw and leave SmackDown out. I know back in the day they used to do the combined Super Shows. It seems kind of early to be, you know, doing the whole Raw SmackDown Super Show thing again. It kind of kills the whole idea of a brand split. So I just assume the reason we're not getting the Slammies is because of that. But because we are not getting the Slammy Awards this year, I've got a few sound-off awards to hand out here. So all hope is not lost. Superstar of the Year. This one should come as no surprise to anybody, especially if you've listened to this podcast. You know my thoughts on this man and his time so far in WWE. And without a doubt to me, and by the way, these awards, quote-unquote, this is not just WWE. But to me, the Superstar of the Year is AJ Styles. AJ Styles has had an incredible year. He's had one of the best first years that anybody has ever had before, and I'll put him up in that same category with guys like Brock Lesnar and Kurt Angle. I'm not saying I'd rank him above those guys. I still think Brock has probably had probably the best year that anybody's ever had in terms of from his debut to the time he won the championship was just a matter of months. You know, even Kurt Angle, it took a little bit longer for him to win his first championship. And the caliber of people that they had Brock destroying and beating just a few months as a rookie into his run. The Rock, Hulk Hogan, The Undertaker. I mean, it's hard to find someone else who's had a better first year than he has. But AJ would have to be up there in that conversation. Here's a guy who a lot of people never thought they would see in WWE. He comes in. and has the level of success that he has had, the reaction from the fans who took to him like a duck to water, you never really know. I mean, WWE, it is a different audience. It's not the same as a TNA audience or a New Japan audience, but they knew who AJ was, and the ones who didn't, you know, they thought enough of the guy to get behind him, start buying his merch. He comes out now, he's supposed to be the top heel on SmackDown. Most of the time, half the building cheers him. That's how much they like this guy. But he goes in there, and he has been an MVP in every sense of the word in this company. When they need him, he goes out there. You know, they needed him to go in there and give Roman Reigns, the brand new champion, some great matches. And he went in there, and he made Roman Reigns. And I'm not saying this to, you know, like, he carried Roman. Roman didn't do anything, but he carried Roman to some extent to some of the best matches of the year. And he made that guy look like $1 million. He made that guy look like just an unstoppable champion. He did his job. He went in there. They had great matches. He had great matches with John Cena, some of the best matches that Cena's had in a while. And he is one of the beneficiaries of this brand split. I was not a fan of this brand split when they started it. I'm still not really sold on it, but he definitely benefited from it because he ended up with a championship out of it, and I would argue that he is the top champion right now in WWE. And I think he's doing a, you know, no pun intended, but he is doing a phenomenal job so far. So to me, he is the superstar of the year. Female star of the year is Charlotte. They are building her up to be something special, and I think she's improved a lot from where she used to be, both in terms of in the ring and also on the mic. Some people find her annoying, but she's a heel. She's supposed to be. I think she carries herself very well. You know, there was a point in time where she kind of seemed a little timid, a little nervous, you know, very early on. But she has, I think, matured into a very confident speaker. And if the crowd is wanting her or heckling her, you know, she's not afraid to kind of react to it. Which is not always the best thing to do. Sometimes it is better just to leave well enough alone and ignore it. But I like the fact that she actually responds to it, you know, because sometimes when you just completely ignore what the fans are saying and what the fans are doing, it's like, you've got to stick to the script. We have to be a robot. We have to follow what we're saying. And she'll break away from that sometimes, and she'll react to it, and she'll get some one-liners in there. And, you know, she's had a lot of great matches this year, her and Sasha. Before they broke the brand split and all the horsewomen got, you know, broken up. Obviously the WrestleMania match, which I think is a little bit overrated. People think that that's, you know, there might be some people upset that I didn't put that match in the top 10. That to me is absolutely not a top 10 match, in WWE this year. There were, you know, maybe top 15, top 20. But I do think people tend to overrate that match a little bit, but it wasn't a bad match. You know, a few botches in there, but I think she's had, you know, a great year. It's very obvious that they're positioning her to be the big, you know, superstar of the division. And she probably will hit her father's 16 titles at some point. She seems to be well on her way. But to me, the female star of the year, you know, Bayley spent most of the year in NXT. Sasha Banks, yeah, you know, yeah, I guess you could say Sasha. But I see Charlotte over Sasha. I gotta say, I haven't been overly impressed by some of the stuff with Sasha recently. I think when she does turn, which I think is going to happen next year, I think she'll be a lot more comfortable in that role. And who knows, a year from now, maybe it'll be Bayley. Bayley will have a full year on the main roster. She may be fighting for the championship. She was super over in NXT. If she can translate some of that to the main roster, then I think she'll do very well for herself next year. But for this year, Charlotte is the female star of the year. Biggest surprise of the year. I don't know about you, but to me, Goldberg squashing Brock Lesnar at Survivor Series is the surprise of the year. Goldberg even coming back to WWE after all these years is one of the biggest surprises of the year. But let alone the fact they would then take this guy who was not on good terms with the company for a very long time and probably still has his enemies and detractors, you know, behind the scenes, you know, make of that what you will. For him to come in and to get the match with Brock, a guy who they have protected at every turn, in every situation. They have protected this guy. He's the guy that broke the streak. He's their big special attraction that you get to see a few times a year, only a few more. He's like their Santa Claus. If Santa made, you know, 5 appearances a year instead of 1. And they put him in the ring with Goldberg, and they friggin' job him out. in 96 seconds. Now, going into it, I was hoping that they would keep the match short. I didn't think they were going to keep it that short. I wanted to see a fight. I didn't get a fight. I got a burial. I got a squash. But that's the way it was designed. And they're telling a story and, okay, blah, 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 I get that. I don't think anybody saw that coming. I certainly didn't. Not the way that they did it. That, to me, was the biggest surprise of the year. The best story of the year, and story doesn't necessarily mean storyline, at least not in the way that I'm using it here. To me, Matt Hardy, broken Matt Hardy, is the best story in wrestling all year. Here's a guy who had his issues, had his demons, was a laughingstock. Let's just be honest here. The guy made himself out to be a laughingstock a number of years ago. And he was going down a bad road. Both of them were. Him and his brother. They were headed down a very dark path. And, you know, Jeff was always the more popular one. And look, Jeff Hardy at one point in like 08 was, if not the number one, like most popular wrestling star in the entire world, he was, you know, number two behind John Cena. That's how popular at one point Jeff Hardy was. And he squandered that. And Matt was always playing second fiddle. He was always taking a backseat to his brother. Everybody always used to say, you know, it was Matt who was the mastermind behind the booking of Omega when they were very young. And Matt's the really smart, cerebral one. And Jeff was always the more kind of crazy, daring, creative one. And, you know, Matt, though, has completely turned that around. And I never in a million years thought, you know, as these guys got older and they're so far removed from their days in WWE, I never thought I'd be sitting here saying that Matt Hardy now is certainly as popular, if not more popular, than Jeff Hardy. It's like Jeff Hardy is willingly and gladly playing the supporting role to his brother and this broken character that he created for himself. He's created this whole universe. It's not just like broken Matt Hardy. It's broken Matt. It's Brother Nero. It's the Gardener. It's King Maxwell. It's like all these different people and all these different personalities. He has created this whole universe unto itself. They just taped a 2-hour Impact show from the guy's house, for crying out loud. I give him all the credit in the world. I think he's creative as hell. I would love to see him take that to a larger scale. I would love to see him take that to WWE one day, but I have no faith that WWE would allow him to be as creative with it. So I say, go wherever you want. Stay with TNA. Go somewhere else. But wherever you go, I hope he never, ever, ever surrenders that creativity. I hope he gets it in writing that he has to retain at least some level of creative freedom over this character, because it would be a shame for him to kind of sacrifice that and for that to be ruined. Because I think he still has a lot of mileage in 2017 with this character. He can keep this going for a while. But he has just completely had this career resurgence, and now he has his son, he has another child on the way now. Life is good, it looks like, for Matt Hardy, and I'm happy for the guy, and I think he's one of the best stories in wrestling all year long. Now, you know how WWE, they do this, when they do the Slammies, they have this LOL moment of the year. Well, I'm giving the LOL moment of the year here to Kalisto for his Lucha Things promo after he found out he was being drafted to SmackDown, talking about doing some good lucha things, losing his train of thought, and then cussing and running away. The first and only time I have ever in my life seen someone botch a promo so badly that they literally cussed and ran away. I'm going to give this promo of the year too while I'm at it. LOL moment of the year and promo of the year goes to Kalisto. I said earlier, it's not very often in wrestling these days that we see something we've never seen before. I can honestly say I had never seen that before. And he'll never live that down. Pay-per-view of the year in WWE. They had a lot of them. They had 15 of them, in fact, this year, not counting the first Roadblock show back in March, which was a network special. Well, I guess they're all network specials now, but I'm not counting that one. As you guys know, I throw up a Twitter poll at the end of each pay-per-view for you guys to vote in. Josh Dabbler, I want to give him a shout-out here. He was kind enough to go back and screenshot the results for me for each of the 12 pay-per-view polls that I put up this year. I did forget to do a poll for two of the shows, Extreme Rules and No Mercy, which I think actually turned out to be two of the better shows all year, naturally. So those are missing from the list, just a little, you know, caveat there. But with just shy of 40,000 votes between these 12 polls, we had just about 40,000 votes this year. 39,904, to be exact. Not that anybody's counting. That's a lot of votes. It was the Battleground show in July, the final pay-per-view before the brand split, that got the most positive response from you guys of any show all year. 92% thumbs up, only 8% thumbs down for a show headlined by the very first triple threat match between The Shield, Roman Reigns, Seth Rollins, and Dean Ambrose, and an outstanding match, which was in our countdown, between Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn. It also featured one of the worst matches of the year for the Intercontinental Championship between Darren Young and The Miz, with a finish that is every bit as bad looking back now as it was when it happened. So we'll kind of forget that that happened. If you're wondering what was voted the worst show of the year, somehow Roadblock, the most recent Roadblock, didn't make the cut. Instead, it was Fastlane in February. Only 16% thumbs up, 84% thumbs down. Ouch. So Battleground, I'm not done here. So I said Battleground is WWE's pay-per-view of the year. And that may well be true. But it was not the pay-per-view of the year. I said these awards are open to more than just WWE. That honor for pay-per-view of the year for any promotion goes to New Japan Pro Wrestling for their Wrestle Kingdom 10 show back on January 4th. That was an incredible show. I reviewed it on Sound Off 418 if you want to go back and hear my thoughts on Wrestle Kingdom. It was the very first pay-per-view from any promotion all year long. So this award was wrapped up on January 4th. Think about that. That's pretty amazing. They already had it in the bag. Who knew? And this is, by the way, this is despite Yoshitatsu turning in a performance on commentary that makes David Otunga sound like fucking Howard Cosell. So Yoshi had his neck broken. He was in a match with AJ Styles. He took a Styles Clash. He did not take it properly, and he broke his neck. And he was out for a very long time. And this was his big return. They put him in the booth with Kevin Kelly and Matt Stryker to provide English translations for all the Japanese promos so people can know what they were saying. And he was absolutely horrendous. He absolutely added nothing to the broadcast. Stryker would ask him a question. He either wouldn't answer, there would be a long period of silence, or he would go, yes. That was his answer. He was awful, right? Some people are just not cut out for commentary. Yoshitatsu is one of those people. Even still, Wrestle Kingdom, easily the best pay-per-view all year. Those top three matches at the top of the card were just outstanding. You had Shibata and Ishii beating the holy hell out of each other for 20 minutes. You had the final match for AJ Styles and for Shinsuke Nakamura in New Japan. Both of them had just given their notice. And that was the one, you know, when the match was over with the big fist bump at the end, knowing that both of them were on their way to WWE. And Okada, in the main event, finally beating Tanahashi at a Tokyo Dome show, which is a story that was playing out for years. You talk about long-term booking and long-term story, you know, like storylines. This story was being told and was unfolding for years. When would Okada be able to beat Tanahashi? I still remember it was, I think, the year before when people thought he was going to finally get the win, and Tanahashi beat him again. And that shot of, I guess it was Ghetto, you know, with Okada kind of escorting him to the back, and Okada, right, one of the biggest stars in New Japan, is just bawling his eyes out. He is in tears. And to rub some salt into the wound, Tanahashi gets up on the ropes and they have the little, you know, translation on the bottom, and he's telling Okada, like, you're not ready yet, or something like that. They were already planting the seeds for Okada to, you know, 1 year later come back and get that big win over Tanahashi, and here he finally did. And it was so good. And that was a time of turmoil in New Japan, because that same night, it was AJ Styles, Carl Anderson, and Luke Gallows. All three of them gave their notice that they were on their way out. And this was only maybe a week or two. It was right around Christmas that Nakamura had given his notice. that he was leaving, and he was one of the biggest stars in the entire company. So was AJ. And the beneficiary of all this turned out to be Kenny Omega, who led a Bullet Club beatdown on AJ before he left. And Omega has gone on to just have a career year for himself, to the point now where he's headlining next week's Wrestle Kingdom against Okada. So, you know, I was talking earlier about, like, the beneficiaries of the brand split, AJ Styles and Becky Lynch being two of them. And I think The Miz, too, has been another beneficiary of the brand split. But in terms of being a beneficiary here of this exodus from New Japan, Kenny Omega has gone from being a star to being a superstar in less than a year. So those are my awards, since we're not getting any slammies this year. So now what I want to do, I want to take a little bit here to kind of do a year in review, just to look back at some of the bigger events that happened this year and some of the surprises, the good, the bad, because 2016 was a very newsworthy, very eventful year in the world of pro wrestling. And I think one of the biggest stories of 2016 has been the rise of the UK wrestling scene. Some people take issue when you use the word boom. They're like, oh, is it really a boom? It's a subjective thing. It's a boom in some ways. It's not a boom in other ways. We'll see how this World of Sport pilot goes. They're airing the first one on New Year's Eve. If that turns out well, that could very well lead to a big boom. But certainly a lot of these big independent promotions that are based in the UK and Scotland and Ireland and places like that have had incredible years with big crowds and a lot of enthusiasm and interest from people all over the world. And now they're on these streaming services so people in other countries can watch them now. It's becoming a very big deal. And it's not just these independent promotions. I mean, the rise of this UK wrestling scene, it's now resulted in a new championship in WWE. And possibly a new weekly show on the network. And then you have your promotions like ICW, like Progress, like Rev Pro. Now What Culture? What Culture has their own pro wrestling promotion? And they're not only bringing in big names. I mean, they've got Kurt Angle, and they have Cody Rhodes that's come in, and Alberto Del Rio. I mean, these are guys I'm sure that don't come cheap, especially like Angle and Del Rio. But they're also showcasing their own homegrown talent, and they're playing to some pretty big crowds into the thousands. I think it was ICW at the Hydro, you know, a month or two ago that had a crowd of 6,000 or 7,000 people. It's a lot of people. I mean, that's a WWE-sized crowd when they go to some of these cities. And WWE is not stupid. They see what's going on. They've taken notice. And when that happens, you know you're doing something right. Because now they either want to copy you or crush you. It's one or the other. Either way, the UK scene has their attention. And I think one of the biggest stories going forward in 2017 is going to be what the fallout is from that. Will we still be talking about this UK boom, so to speak, a year from now? You've got, you know, guys like Drew Galloway, Zack Sabre Jr., Will Ospreay, Marty Scurll, Jack Gallagher, Tommy End, who has signed and is ready to go in NXT whenever they see fit to debut him. Those are just some of the names. I mean, there's a bunch of other ones too. But there's a lot of great talent coming out of the UK scene this year. And that kind of leads into another big story from the year. This goes far beyond the UK, even here in this country. I think one of the big stories has been WWE's, what I call their indie embrace. Right, they've been forging relationships with promotions like Evolve. Evolve has all but turned into a feeder system for them. Because you know that if they have interest in someone from Evolve, they're going to get them. So that's kind of what Evolve has turned into. But they're also, you know, creating relationships with other companies as well. And it's cool to see on the one hand, but I still, you know, on the other hand, it's like, what are they getting out of this? What is the long-term play here? And is it just them being nice? Is it just them realizing that, hey, we have a lot to gain here by being friendly with these people instead of just kind of turning a cold shoulder? Because for so long, that's what they did with the indie scene. They were either just directly hostile towards it, or they just ignored it because, you know, we're not going to take anybody from the indies. There was a period where that was the case. That was the mentality. And now they've done a complete 180. And it, in a lot of ways, it is very cool to see. It's cool to be reading an article on WWE.com about Gabe Sapolsky and about people and things that two, 3 years ago, you never in a million years would have expected to see. We've had the addition of new content on the network. Really, all throughout the year, they've been adding new stuff to the network. I'll tell you, one of the things I've really become a big fan of, and it's become my favorite show, is this story time show. It's this animated retelling of actual, like, road stories. And they have, like, five stories or so. There you go. Per show. They're very, very short. That's the only thing. I wish they were longer. They're literally, like, one episode could be 10 minutes. Another one could be 12. They're very, very short. And they pass way too quickly. But that is one of my new guilty pleasures on the network. But they've added content like the Cruiserweight Classic. Again, something that you would never even fathom just a few years ago WWE would ever do. They would bring in talent from all over the world, even ones who weren't signed, and they would feature them in this tournament. It was amazing. 205 Live, of course, is the spinoff of that. Not as good, but still, you know, they're giving the Cruiserweights a platform. They're probably going to end up doing the same thing with the UK talent, because they're in just total content creation mode for this network right now. Any kind of first-run weekly programming that they could create, they're going to go ahead and do it. So this is only the beginning. We're going to see more of it in 2017, because guess what? You got 7 days in a week, and not all of those 7 days are filled up just yet, but I do think that's their goal. We have the return of the brand split for the first time in many years, which also means the return to two main championships. There was a lot of divided opinion over this when they first made the announcement this summer about the brand split coming back. I was certainly not a fan. I mean, we talked about the pros and cons of it. There have been some beneficiaries, people like AJ Styles, people like The Miz, people like Becky Lynch, who may not have had a championship were it not for there being a second title. Alexa Bliss, I mean, there have been people that are benefiting from this right now, absolutely, who would not have before. I still don't see the need to have a brand split. And I just think it's, you know, with all the titles and everything else, I think it's overkill. I'm still not completely sold on the idea. But they did it because they felt they had to, and because really one of the main reasons they did, let's be honest here, SmackDown moved to USA Network. And it was in WWE's best interest to make SmackDown as strong of a show as possible. Not only did they move, SmackDown went live, it was a very big deal. I guess that was another big story, the fact that SmackDown went live finally weekly for the first time since its inception, which goes all the way back to 99. And for years, people were like, oh, why isn't SmackDown live? There's always spoilers. Well, now you don't have that problem anymore. But that was one of the major, really the impetus, I think, for the return of the brand split. And I don't know that that was a USA Network decree, but I think it was their way to try to make SmackDown stronger. And SmackDown is stronger. They have succeeded in that respect. The ratings are higher, I think, than they were averaging before. SmackDown, in my opinion, in a lot of ways, SmackDown has become the A-show. Kind of reminds me of 2002-2003, where SmackDown was much preferred over Raw. I feel the same way now. I much prefer SmackDown over Raw. It's a lot easier to watch. I find some of the stories on that show more compelling. We get good matches. I don't find the authority figures to be as overbearing as they are on Raw. So I think SmackDown has the edge in a lot of ways. Commentary, I love Mauro Ranallo, but I can no longer say commentary is one of those reasons, because we have to deal with JBL and David Otunga. But nonetheless, I still personally am not sold on this whole idea of a brand split. But that was a very big deal, and it's not going away anytime soon. I'm not saying 5 years from now the brands will still be split. I'm sure at some point they will probably revert back to the way they were. But I don't think it's going to be for a while. I think they're going to be in this for the long haul. We're going to have two champions. I do think it dilutes things a little bit. But if they play their cards right, see, my biggest criticism of the original brand split was they got lazy after a while and they gave up trying to make it like a real split. And there was a lot of mixing of the brands, and it got to the point where they truly did not give a shit. To the point where Alberto Del Rio, I can remember this, he was the world heavyweight champion. Why they even still had a second world title is beyond me. And there is Alberto Del Rio, who I think was supposed to be a SmackDown guy, but they weren't really enforcing those rules anymore. There he is on Monday Night Raw in the opening match, like 8:30, whatever it was, in the opening match after the initial, show opening promo, defending the world heavyweight title like it was the fucking TV title. And I'm like, why? Why is this going on? Why even have a championship? What is the point? And eventually they just abandoned the whole thing. But that's where we had gotten to in this. They were so lazy. And they had so given up on the idea of a split. There really was no split anymore. But they let it drag on for so long before they officially ended it that it just completely soured me on the whole idea of a split. And I had no faith in these people. The same people are booking the split now who did 5, 10 years ago, you know, whatever it was. And so why should we have faith that these same people who couldn't do it right the first time are going to get it right the second time? Now, we're still in the honeymoon phase. This split's only been going on since the end of July. I mean, they didn't really even start the split brand pay-per-views until September. So we got a ways to go before we can really look back and say, okay, this thing has been a real success. We'll be able to do that in 2017. We'll see. But that was the reason I was so hostile towards the idea, because why should I think that this is going to be any different? Daniel Bryan, mentioned him before. One of the big stories of the year was Daniel Bryan forced to retire. This was a story that was dragging out for a very long time. He had been hurt. He had neck surgery. He was having issues with strength in one of his arms. He was still having problems. They couldn't figure out why. One doctor said, you need another surgery. Another doctor said, no, you don't. The concussions, he did come back, but then he got concussed, and the concussions became an issue, and he had all types of tests done, and different doctors cleared him. But WWE had already made the decision that they were not going to let him back in the ring, and I think the reason was, as we found out later on, is that he had confided in his wife that he had suffered some seizures, at least after one of his earlier concussions. And this is contrary to what some people think. Apparently, this is not anything recent. This was something that happened a number of years ago. And he had confided this in her, and I guess the idea was that if you get concussed one more time, we have to tell WWE. And I'm glad he did, you know, for his own health and well-being, but at the same time, that was his downfall. Because once WWE became aware of the fact that this guy was having freaking seizures, that was it. There was no way they were ever going to let him back in the ring again. Every doctor in the world could clear him and give him a clean bill of health. I think that was what did it. I really do. I think that was the reason that they will never, ever clear him to wrestle in their ring again. And so his career effectively came to an end. They were in his home state of Washington back in February, and Vince called him up and said, this would be a good place for you to come and make it official. And he didn't want to do it, but he did anyway. And they've since transitioned him into the role of general manager. But if his contract ever does come to an end, and I'm not sure how that whole situation is working. I assume that because he is working, so long as he is working for them and appearing on TV, the contract is still ticking down. If that contract ever does run out, I don't know if they'll try to freeze it and say, well, he's not wrestling, and so they may pull some kind of shit like that. I would not put that past them. But if his contract ever does come due, I don't know that we've seen the last of Daniel Bryan in a wrestling ring. I just think he loves wrestling so much, and he can't help himself. Even if it is like one final retirement tour, I just feel like at some point, it won't be in WWE, but at some point, we are going to see this guy back in the ring. I really feel like we have not seen the last of him inside a wrestling ring. Because he's still, you could tell, he still feels that strongly about it. There are times he'll say things on Talking Smack where I'm almost thinking to myself, is he trying to get fired? Maybe he is. Maybe he just doesn't care. But it was very sad. It was a very sad emotional thing to see somebody who loves wrestling so much and who thinks, I can still do this. I'm in my prime. My God, look at all this talent coming in. Freaking Kevin Owens, AJ Styles, Shinsuke Nakamura, who may still be his favorite wrestler in the entire world. And Nakamura even said one of the things that disappointed him the most is one of the reasons he even came to WWE and came to the States was he wanted to wrestle Daniel Bryan. And it just so happened that all these guys came in and Bryan couldn't get in the ring with any of them. And it's a really, really sad thing. But like I said, in terms of WWE, he may be done, but I'm not so sure he's done for good. AJ Styles finally makes it to WWE, one of the bigger surprises of the year. Made his debut in the Royal Rumble match, and from there had that match with Chris Jericho at WrestleMania, which was a great match. Came out on the losing end of it, but ended up becoming number one contender for the championship. There was a great fatal four-way. I think it was on Raw the night after WrestleMania that earned him the number one contendership. And had a great series of matches with Roman Reigns. Had his luck gone a little bit differently, because it was in June that Roman got popped on that failed drug test. Had that happened a month earlier, they probably would have gotten that championship on AJ even earlier than they did. But he, you know, went on to have the series of matches he did with John Cena. He got the big, clean win over him at SummerSlam. And it's not very often that we see John Cena losing clean in the middle like that on a big show, but he did there. I mean, he's done a few times. He lost to The Rock and maybe a few other people, but it's still not something you see very often. And with this brand split, he's become the number one star on SmackDown and one of the top heels in the company, and he is now WWE champion for over 100 days, and we'll see if he drops it at the Rumble or if he can go all the way to Mania with it, but he has been an MVP for this company this year. I think that he is one of the best wrestlers, if not the best in the entire world right now. He is the complete package. He can do things in there that a lot of other people can't do. And I really think that he, even more so than someone like Seth Rollins, because there were people making the Rollins-Shawn Michaels comparison even just a couple of years ago. I have to say, look, I don't want to make it sound like I'm bashing Seth Rollins, but being that I brought his name up, I do feel like Seth Rollins is off a step since he came back. And I don't know if it's just because of the surgery. There's, you know, a certain speed he was on before that he can't get to now, or if he's just being overly cautious because he was hurt. But I look at Seth Rollins now, and Seth Rollins in the ring that I see now is not the same Seth Rollins that we saw a year ago. He's a little slower. It's something off about him. Still a great wrestler. Still one of the best they have in the entire company. But if I was going to make a comparison to Shawn Michaels, if there was anybody in the company right now who I would say this guy is the closest thing to a Shawn Michaels that they've got, it's AJ Styles. He's the guy. He can go in there and get in the ring with anybody and make them look like $1 million, even if they're not that good. He'll bump his ass off for you. I just think he is, he's just a fantastic pro wrestler, and he's had a career year for himself. One of the few guys who's been able to do it in three different companies the way that he has. He did it in TNA. He did it in New Japan, which is no easy task, coming in as the, you know, as the foreigner. And now he's done it in WWE, where people didn't even think he'd ever make it to, almost 40 years old, and here he is having arguably the best year of his entire life. So hopefully that carries over into 2017. Hopefully we'll get to see an AJ Nakamura match like we did at Wrestle Kingdom. We'll see that at some point, maybe at a WrestleMania. That'd be kind of cool. Maybe WrestleMania 34. But that was one of the bigger stories of the year, him coming over to WWE. Speaking of Nakamura, have him on my list as well. Shinsuke Nakamura making his debut in NXT, taking a chance on his career. WWE does not exactly have a great history of integrating Japanese talent onto their roster and using them at a very high level. And Nakamura was about as high level as you could get in Japan. I mean, I think back to New Japan when he was there, and there was like a pecking order, and there was a top three. And to me, it was Tanahashi, Okada, and Nakamura. And, you know, he gave up a sure thing to take a chance on himself. And so far, it seems to be paying off, even though he still has yet to make it to the main roster. I have no doubt at some point he will. One would think he has to in 2017. But I say that, and then I think to myself, well, Sami Zayn spent 3 years in NXT. Over 3 years in NXT. Finn Balor spent almost 2 years in NXT. And these were hardly guys who needed to spend that much time down there. A few months, maybe max. But this guy's there for 2 years. This year's guy for 3 years. It's nuts. I mean, let's be honest. NXT needed them a hell of a lot more than they needed NXT. But what it's done in keeping Nakamura down there is it's given him a chance to prove that he could be a top guy. You know, that the American audience can buy him as a top guy. Although I will say, you know, the NXT audience is very different than the mainstream audience. There are definite differences there. The jury is still out on whether or not your average fan, your casual fan, hey, Raw's in, you know, Louisville, Kentucky, or Raw tonight is in Wheeling, West Virginia. Is Nakamura going to get over in front of those crowds the same way he does at Full Sail? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. I think it lies in the booking, but the jury is out on that until that day comes. We just don't know. His English still isn't great. You know, people have said, oh, his English is pretty good. I have had a conversation with the guy. Actually, I am speaking from personal experience because I got a chance to interview him for a few minutes. at the 2K17 launch party, and he had a woman there translating for him. His English really is not that great. It was a struggle. I mean, you would be amazed at what I had to edit out of that interview. The long pauses, and he was struggling for words at different points. So contrary to what I hear some people saying, I really don't think his English is all that great. And I do think that, you know, as reliant as they are when it comes to promo skills, when you get to that main roster, even more so than NXT, I think that could be a big problem for him. You know, the bigger question is this. All of this doesn't even matter. It boils down to one man, Vince McMahon. Will Vince McMahon give him a chance? We know Triple H will. But will Vince? He's got that superstar aura. He's got the charisma. He's got the music and the big-time rock star entrance, which is so important in WWE. But will Vince McMahon see him that way? Will Vince McMahon see him at that level? Will Vince McMahon see fit to put him in pay-per-view main events? That's the question that worries me. We had the return of Shane McMahon, another one of those big surprises this year. I can't tell you how many email questions I got over the years. What happened with Shane and Vince? Is Shane ever going to come back? Do you think he's ever going to be back on TV? Because he was gone for so long. He was gone for like 7 years. And out of the blue, he's back, just like that. And in a Hell in a Cell match with The Undertaker, or WrestleMania. It sounds like something you'd play in a video game. But that was actually one of the top matches at WrestleMania this year. I like Shane. Shane, to me, always came across as one of the more sane, rational McMahons. I don't know them personally, but certainly his TV persona always came off that way. He was probably the least grating of all of the McMahons on TV. And when he would have matches, you know, I don't think he's ever been professionally trained, but the guy is a fucking maniac. And he had a hell of a lot of just entertaining matches over the years. I mean, I can go back to the very beginning and the street fight with Kurt Angle and even the match with Vince, the street fight they had at WrestleMania at the Astrodome. Some of the matches he had with Kane. I mean, Shane is a fun performer more often than not to watch. I don't know that he should be wrestling very often now. He's almost 50 and he almost got killed by Roman Reigns at Survivor Series, but maybe that's a sign that he ought to slow down a little bit. I'm at least happy they seem to have gotten away from this idea that it's going to be Shane and Brock Lesnar. Hopefully we can put that shit to bed. Hopefully we never have to see that. I even said, like, if that was the idea coming out of SummerSlam, because clearly it looked like they were building something with him and Shane, and Shane even went on SmackDown and said, this is not over, and then they never went back to it. I would be okay if at some point it kind of manifested itself into Shane bringing in some sort of hired gun or some kind of surrogate to wrestle Brock on his behalf. I would be just as happy with them dropping the whole storyline altogether. But Shane being back as an on-air character on TV has been kind of cool. I think one of the stories to watch for maybe going forward is if he can somehow integrate himself even more into the corporate structure in the company. Right now, it's just purely a television role. I'd have to think he'd love to kind of get back in there in some form or fashion. We had the story come out a few weeks ago that there was a meeting that he brokered, or Kevin Dunn brokered, in 2012 with him and Vince, where Shane's idea was that he'd come back and he would take over all of creative. And that, I'm sure, didn't sit very well with Triple H and Stephanie. So you know that there's still some tensions there, and I still would love to see them just, again, play off reality, come up with some kind of storyline next year where we can get Shane and Triple H face-to-face, and I would like to see that. We had the evolution of Chris Jericho this year. I mean, how many things did this guy get over throughout the course of the year, right? He got over a potted plant named Mitch. He got over a scarf. He got over a list. He got over the word it. He got over the phrase stupid idiot, which he stole from five-year-olds across the country. There is nothing that this man, I think, did not touch this year that did not turn to gold. I think Jericho had one of his best years ever. Which is saying a lot, because he's been in wrestling a long time. He's come back, he's left, he's come back, he's left. And I don't think this tops the run he had in 08. I still think that was Jericho at his best, and that whole feud with Shawn Michaels. But this is right below that. I really think this is right below that. He's on one of the best runs he's ever had. And I've been enjoying all of the interplay and the banter with him and Kevin Owens. We'll see if it leads to a match between them at WrestleMania. I would think at some point it has to lead to a match between the two of them. And since they're not doing it at the Rumble, Mania would seem like the place to do that. But yeah, that's been one of the big stories of the year, I think, has been the rise, again, of Y2J. We had the death of the Divas and the Butterfly Belt, thank God. No more Butterfly Belt. They are no longer Divas, even though we still have a TV show called Total Divas. But they are now women. It is the Women's Revolution in WWE. It is one of those buzzwords they love so much. I was happy. To me, the word Divas was always dumb, because the word Divas has a negative connotation. So why would you want to call your entire division of women... you may as well just call them bitches, right? It's the WWE bitches division. Like, you wouldn't do that. That would be incredibly insulting. So I never really understood why they used that word in the first place, but I was just happy they got rid of that belt. That god-awful-looking toy had to die a horrible death. They finally got rid of that thing, and now they have a more... they have a more, you know, respectable-looking championship, although the thing is, like, all the titles now, except for the U.S. and the Intercontinental, they all look the same. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like, they're all the same, but, like, multicolored. So at some point we'll have a red one, a blue one, a green one. It's like fucking Skittles. I just wish there was a little more creativity when it came to the belts, but anything is an improvement over the Butterfly Belt. The women, we had them headlining their very first pay-per-view this year, Sasha and Charlotte in that Hell in a Cell match. Hopefully that's a sign of things to come. I do think that they... you could take a pay-per-view here and there and have the women headline. If the story is strong enough, whether or not they have a dick between their legs really shouldn't make a difference. If the story is strong and, you know, you feel like this is one of the bigger matches on the show, I'd like to see them get another chance to headline more pay-per-views going forward. We have the end of the John Cena era. I would argue John Cena as a full-time performer. I think it's pretty much the end of John Cena as a full-time performer as we know it. I think going forward, we're going to see more of this where he's there for a few months and then he disappears for a few months. He's got more TV roles. He's got more movie roles coming his way. It's like The Rock all over again. I don't know that he'll ever be as famous and as successful as The Rock, but he's on his path, right? People in Hollywood have taken notice. He still has yet to have a really successful project. None of his movies that he's been a star in have done particularly well. He's had a couple of fun cameos in movies. I wouldn't call them his movies. This TV show, American Grit, apparently did not do very well at all, ratings-wise. I don't know why they renewed it, but they did. We'll see if season two does any better. So it is kind of funny. I think Cena, like I saw him on SNL, and I think he's got, you know, a great personality and he can be a really funny guy. But if you really look at his career outside of WWE so far, he really hasn't had a lot of like real success. The Rock, I think, early on had more success than Cena has had. But Cena, you know, look, he looks a certain way. He's got, you know, the personality and the charisma. He's going to get a lot of chances, and we'll see how far he can run with it. If he's a bust, he'll come back. If he's not, then I think this is the beginning of the end. And I'm sure that's going to make a lot of people very happy, because they're just sick to death of John Cena. But I also think it pretty much signals the end of any hope. I hope we could put this to bed that, you know, John Cena, maybe now they can turn him heel. The big John Cena heel turn. I don't think it's ever happening. I think that ship sailed a long time ago. I think the closest we ever came to it, and Cena talked about it himself, was around the time of that first WrestleMania match with The Rock, or maybe a little before it. He had new gear made. He was having new music made. He thought he was going heel, either before that match or coming out of that match. And Vince got cold feet, you know, he sells a lot of t-shirts. And they abandoned the idea. And I think at that point, the little sailboat went away. Off into the distance it went. And that was the end of it. I think we can finally give up the idea here that John Cena is, you know, going to become a bad guy. It ain't happening. It ain't happening. I think we're going to get him in smaller doses. I think that he will become... kind of a special attraction type. I do think he's going to win number 16 at some point and tie Flair's record. I don't think we're done seeing, you know, WWE champion John Cena, but that does not mean that, you know, he is back as a full-time performer. He could win the championship and then drop it a month or two later. But I do think it's the end of an era. And it feels like it, too. It feels like the end of an era. It feels like we're finally moving past, you know, the Cena stuff. He's been on top for so long. I mean, it's been well over a decade. He had a longer run than Hogan had when Hogan was at his peak. Austin, Austin had a very short run, if you really look at it. Rock 2. Cena, I would argue, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I would argue that John Cena has had the longest run on top of any top guy in the history of WWE. Even Bruno. Bruno, when he was champion, he had that 8-year run as the champ. But it wasn't long after that, I think, that he retired, and he may have come back, but then he left again. So maybe you can say Bruno, but to me, it's John Cena. I mean, he outlasted them all. He's been on top longer than anybody else. I don't know if that's because he's so great as a top guy, or if it's more of an indictment on WWE and their inability to find or create that next big larger-than-life star. And so we just got to go with Cena. I mean, look, Vince McMahon was always looking for that next big star, even when Hogan was on top. The great story of he thought he found the next Hogan in that Tom McGee guy. Tom McGee was like a gymnast. He looked like $1 million. He couldn't wrestle for shit. He had one really great match with Bret Hart that nobody's ever seen except the people in the building. I'd love to see them put that on the network. But he had one great house show match with Bret Hart that Vince saw, and Vince fell in love with the guy. Yeah, he fell in love with the guy because Bret Hart was a great pro wrestler. Everyone else that he wrestled, he looked like dog shit. He had two left feet. Didn't know what he was doing. But that was in 86. He thought he found the next Hogan in 86, and Hogan was still at his peak. So, again, if they would have found someone, or if they found that guy, they would have knocked Cena off that perch a long time ago. And I do think that part of it, you know, is blame that has to go to WWE for their inability to either find or create that next big star. And that, as much as anything, I think, is why Cena has been able to spend so much time on top. We had the return of Goldberg this year. I talked about that already a little bit earlier, that big shock win over Brock Lesnar at Survivor Series. And I'm sure that it will lead to a rematch at WrestleMania, that Brock will get his win back. It only makes sense. I think Brock has another year or so left on his contract. He's still their big special attraction. I don't know how long Goldberg signed for. It might just be through WrestleMania. He might just be done at that point. I don't know that I see Goldberg. Yeah, I shouldn't say that, because we're in uncharted territory here. I don't think anybody expected Goldberg to come back, let alone then sign an extension. So now he's doing more than one match. If all goes well, who's to say, right? Who's to say that they don't sign Goldberg to a special contract like they did Brock, and we see Goldberg wrestle a few big matches next year against, you know, Cena or Roman Reigns or someone like that. Anything's possible. But certainly the return of Goldberg was one of the bigger stories in the second half of the year. James Ellsworth. Who the hell saw that coming? James Ellsworth was a job guy brought in to get his ass kicked by Braun Strowman. And for some reason, people took to this guy. Vince apparently took a liking to him. He looks like a bit of an oddball. He certainly has a very unique look to him. No chin, the whole thing. And they brought him back, and the people started to buy into him as this underdog. And again, if you use the guy sporadically here and there, I think you could have gotten a lot more mileage out of him. But then they just started using him every single week, to the point where he was involved in the top storyline with the WWE champion on SmackDown. It got to the point of, all right, really? Like, I think this is long past its expiration point. But credit to him. He earned himself a contract out of it. He is now an official WWE contracted superstar. Got his own t-shirt that apparently sold very well. I think as each week goes by, and now he's not quite the big white meat baby face he was before, I think the bloom is kind of off the rose. We'll see if he's as popular with the crowd a couple of months from now. He certainly wasn't on Tuesday night in the match against AJ. He got his ass kicked and people cheered. So again, I think the bloom may be off that rose by now, but he was probably the most unexpected story of 2016. The fact that he would get over the way he did and would earn a contract out of it is pretty incredible. Definitely, you could argue James Ellsworth, perhaps the biggest beneficiary of WWE having this brand split. We had New Day smashing Demolition's record of longest reigning tag team champions of all time, 478 days. I believe their reign came to an end at 483. So that's a nice accomplishment for them. Get themselves in the record books. The broken brilliance of Matt Hardy, which I talked about a little bit earlier, the year he finally overtook his brother, Brother Nero, as the most popular member of the Hardy clan, and having himself the best year of his career. Billy Corgan and Dixie Carter, that whole debacle, ugh, What a story that was. What a story. The front man for Smashing Pumpkins comes in. He invests. He injects his own money, his own capital into TNA. Gets screwed. It goes to court. It becomes a big back and forth legal battle. Then he gets bought out or paid back or whatever. And the whole thing now is... I shouldn't say the whole thing is over, because again, I do still think his suit is outstanding against Dixie. And I'd like to see him actually win some money from her. That'd be kind of nice. But what a disaster that was. But what it led to was one of the biggest stories of the year. And I think this will end up being a big story in 2017. After all these years of TNA, the good, the bad, the ugly, they're going to go out of business. People have been saying that for the last 15 years. Now we finally are in a situation where TNA is under new leadership. I mean, Dixie is still in the picture, but she is not in power anymore. Anthem Sports now runs and controls TNA, and this is going to be the first year, if they make it the full year, the first full year of TNA under new leadership since the very early days, where it went from the Jarretts to the Carters, and it's pretty much been the Dixie reign ever since, and now it's Anthem Sports. And we're going to see what they've got up their sleeve. We're going to see if TNA starts touring again. We're going to see if they get out of the impact zone, they take their show on the road, what talent they might be able to get. I think it's safe to say TNA can now keep floating along. I don't think they're in jeopardy of dying the way that it seemed they were just about a month or two ago. But it's going to be a different year for them. They're under new management for the first time. And last but not least here, CM Punk. CM Punk finally, after 2 years, made his UFC debut against Mickey Gall. And it did not go well for CM Punk. But I give the guy a lot of credit. He worked his ass off. He trained. I don't know if he had to cut weight or anything like that. But he clearly was taking this seriously. He got a very nice payday for it. I know some people despise Punk. They still hold it against him the way he left and all that. And it's just comical to me. I think those people need to just get over themselves. But look, the guy went in there, he took a beating, and apparently he's coming back for more. I think it's incredibly stupid. I think it's ridiculous that UFC would even give him another chance. He doesn't deserve to be, hanging with those guys. But again, UFC is also under new management now. You know, the big $4 billion sale, it ain't the Fertittas anymore. They are under new management, and they're going to want big fights with big names. And CM Punk is still, he still has a name. So from the freak show perspective, I get it. But it's let's be honest here. I mean, it's a joke. It was a joke in the first place that he would get a UFC fight with no prior fight experience. Had he gone in there and actually impressed people, or won, or come close to winning, you could argue, you know what? He earned another shot. Maybe the pay-per-view did really well. Punk actually had a good showing for himself. He got himself he earned himself a second fight. He did nothing in that first fight to earn himself a second fight, but he's probably going to get it anyway. I don't know who it'll be against. I don't think the outcome is going to be much different than the first time, but hopefully he'll at least get paid very well for it. Brock Lesnar, on the other hand, he made his return to the UFC. He was very successful. He got a win over Mark Hunt, which then was not overturned, but it was changed to a no contest because he got popped on a drug violation. In fact, he was just suspended for a year by the Nevada State Athletic Commission, fined $250,000 of what I think was a $2.5 million purse. I'm sure he's just heartbroken over that. And his suspension is going to be up right around the time of UFC's next big show in the summer. So I don't think we've seen the last of Brock Lesnar inside the UFC. We shall see. And that wraps up, I think, most of the big stories for 2016. There's your year in review. A very interesting year, and I think there'll be more interesting things afoot in 2017. High Society, Thurman Taylor IV, thank you for your PayPal donation. Also, Gabriel Dirty Sanchez, Bobby the Wizard Waldrop, Samuel the Slayer Cipperoni, the Seattle Saint, Marco Wallace, who just turned 19, so happy birthday, Marco. And Hytham, the Equalizer, Al Nawasser, thank you very much for your PayPal support, not just this week, but all throughout the year. We're over 90 minutes deep, and we're first getting to the Raw review. There's a lot of stuff on the show. I told you there was. Monday Night Raw last week was live from Columbus, Ohio. I did go through all of the Raw polls that I did on Twitter for this year, by the way. I had a couple of people ask me about that. They wanted to know what the best liked and the least liked episodes of Raw this year were. And so, here you go. February 29 episode of Raw earned 13% thumbs up, 87% thumbs down. That was for a show that had a Dean Ambrose, Alberto Del Rio main event. March 21st, 11% thumbs up, 89% thumbs down, with a Dean Ambrose, Braun Strowman main event. I believe that was the worst rating for a Raw all year in terms of our poll. 11 up, 89 down. That is just awful. The two best episodes of Raw, April 4th. That was the post-WrestleMania show, 89% thumbs up, 11% thumbs down. So the exact reverse of the one I just mentioned. That was the post-Mania show. That was the one where AJ Styles won that excellent Fatal 4-Way match in the main event. And the other one was August 29th. 93% thumbs up, 7% thumbs down, by far the best rated episode of Raw all year based on our polls. That was the show with the Fatal 4-Way to crown a new Universal Champion after Finn Balor got hurt. Triple H came back, he turned on Seth Rollins, and he helped Kevin Owens win the championship. And that was the show that earned the best rating, 93 up, 7 down. Now, there is one caveat here, and that is that one of the best Raws all year, from top to bottom, it was just a great show, 3 hours that just passed like nothing, was that first post-draft show. It was the July 25th episode of Raw. That was the one where Finn Balor beat Roman Reigns clean in the main event. For some reason, I could not find a poll for that day. And I don't even know why. I mean, I watched the show live. I enjoyed it. I don't know why I wouldn't have put one up unless I just missed it. But I guess I didn't do one. So you can throw that one on the list, too. I mean, we'll never know, I guess, if that one would have gotten more than 93% thumbs up like the August 29th one did. But the August 29th one with Kevin Owens' big win and that first Raw after the brand split, those were probably the two best Raw shows all year. And so there you go. Now you know the numbers. And as far as this week's show goes, this week's show will not go down as one of the better shows of the year. In fact, I thought this was one of the worst, most uninspired Raw shows of the entire year. And you guys seem to reflect that on the Twitter poll. Almost 1,800 votes. 22% thumbs up, 78% thumbs down. Just a painfully boring show. With Mick Foley wearing maybe the worst shirt I've ever seen in all my life. It made me long for the days where he would wear the flannel. Foley also made a main event for this show right here in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The only problem is they were in Columbus, as in Columbus, Ohio. That did not go over very well with the crowd. I will cut the guy some slack. He wasn't even supposed to be on this show. If you remember, I mentioned he had requested time off. WWE put a statement out to, might have been PW Insider or one of the sites, that said he was going to be off television until January 2nd. And then all of a sudden, there he was at the pay-per-view. And there he was on Raw the next night. Now, I don't think he's supposed to be on the show this Monday. I guess we'll see. I believe now he is gone until January 2nd, but yeah, they called him back early because I guess, you know, Stephanie is also away. She's been off TV the last few weeks, and they're sure as hell not going to call her back early. Say, hey, let's call Foley back. The Universal title match is now set for the Royal Rumble. It is not a four-way as I thought it would be. I thought it, you know, would be Reigns, Rollins, Owens, and Jericho. Instead, it will be a rematch between Roman Reigns and Kevin Owens for the Universal Championship, and I guess not the U.S. title. And this time, Chris Jericho, to make sure he does not interfere, will be suspended high above the ring in a shark cage. Now, this might have been more effective had we not just seen a match in NXT with Paul Ellering suspended above the ring in a shark cage with the same premise that we're going to do this so that Paul Ellering can't get involved. And yet in that match, what did we see? We saw Paul Ellering drop a chain down into the ring to one of his men. Now, granted, the chain never came into play because the chain accidentally went flying out of his hand and into the crowd. But still, given that they just did this a month ago, I think it makes this a little tough to buy into the idea that just because Jericho will be suspended above the ring, it somehow means he can't find a way to get involved. The one thing it does do, it takes Roman Reigns, seemingly, I shouldn't say for sure, but seemingly it takes Roman Reigns out of the 30-man Royal Rumble match, so that's a plus. I have no interest in seeing another Royal Rumble match get shat on by the crowd, by all the angry fans when the big dog points to the WrestleMania sign as they go off the air. So that's a plus. Sasha Banks cut a promo where she teased that maybe I'm not the boss anymore. She's doubting herself. And Nia Jax came out and beat her up, so that looks to be the next match. I would say that this would have been a perfect spot to reintroduce Emma. But they're still, you know, dicking around and playing games with her debut, so we're getting Nia Jax instead. By the way, let me comment on this real quick. I've seen rumors floating around. I don't know where they come from, if they're legit or not. Maybe it's just wishful thinking by somebody who floated the idea, but I'm seeing rumors of there being a women's Royal Rumble this year on the pay-per-view. I don't like it. And the reason I don't like it is because it reminds me of when they used to do two Money in the Bank matches. I think more than one Rumble on that show is overkill. It's not because I don't think the women, you know, they don't deserve to have their own Rumble. The idea of having two Royal Rumbles on the same show to me is, it's too much. I just think it's overkill. So I don't like it. They introduce new Raw tag team belts. They have the silver, just like the SmackDown belts do, but with a red strap. So, Raw already copying off of SmackDown. How many belts has this company created this year? I've lost track. I mean, I know they have the new UK title, which actually looks kind of nice. The Universal title. The new women's belt that replaced the whole butterfly atrocity. We've got two new sets of tag team belts now. We've got a cruiserweight belt. I mean, even I finally got my Winged Eagle this year. Thanks to Matt. Belts for everyone! Everyone gets a belt. Neville cut his first heel promo, a rare in-ring interview for this guy. He talked about obliterating the entire cruiserweight division. I'm digging heel Neville so far. They had Enzo Amore. Look, the thing about Neville, I'm just happy the guy's on TV. For so long, he wasn't hurt. He was just gone, missing in action. Wrestling dark matches. The guy is one of the most talented performers on any roster that they have. And for him to be just wasting away in the back is a crime. So whether you buy into heel Neville or you don't, and I do, just be happy the guy is finally getting some TV time. That's the most important thing. They had Enzo Amore. Oh, by the way, one more thing here. Somebody, I wish I would have taken this person's name down, but somebody floated the idea to me. Now, you know, the idea that I had was before they turned Neville heel, I was hoping they would bring him in to the cruiserweight division. And once Austin Aries was all healed up from his injury, they could build to like an Aries Neville program. Cause I think that would be awesome. But somebody made a very interesting suggestion. I don't know that they would do this because again, he is not under contract. I think Triple H has no problem bringing this guy in for NXT shows, but I would love, how about this? He pitched the idea of heel Neville winning the cruiserweight title and then bringing in Kota Ibushi for a special match at WrestleMania. So you do Neville and Ibushi at WrestleMania. Now that would be a hell of a match. That would be, I mean, in terms of the cruiserweights, you're looking for a WrestleMania caliber match. There it is. I mean, I wouldn't even have a problem if they brought in Ibushi for the TakeOver show that weekend and they let Neville go down to NXT, you know, bring him back down for one night to NXT and they do the match there. I just think in terms of a WrestleMania weekend match, they got to get Ibushi in for something. And him and Neville, I mean, that would just be off the charts. They had Enzo Amore getting served with a letter backstage about exposing himself on TV a few weeks ago when that was when he got caught naked in the hallway. And he was being ordered to attend sensitivity training tonight. A session that included such greats as Darren Young and Jinder Mahal. This was horrendous. If you enjoyed it, more power to you. They are very hit and miss with their comedy. I thought this was just awful. Braun Strowman, who was on a rampage after his loss to Sami Zayn, interfered in a match between Sin Cara and Titus O'Neil, otherwise referred to as ratings poison. But thank God for Strowman. He killed them both. This thing didn't go 30 seconds. He even threw Sin Cara off the Raw stage through a bunch of tables and Christmas presents, and then he pushed over some Christmas trees. He is probably as sick as I am of all these radio stations with their 24-hour Christmas music. I can't say that I blame him. I think they should have their licenses revoked. Charlotte and Bayley had an armbar contest that was disguised as a match for the first 5 or 6 minutes. Bayley won with a backslide, although it looked like Charlotte's shoulder may have been up. They're playing it up that Bayley is now 3-0 against Charlotte. I swear to God, I can't remember where those first two wins came from. I don't doubt that they happened, but I think I've been so checked out of this show of late, I just don't remember. I remember Charlotte turning on her and beating her ass at Survivor Series, but I don't remember anything else. I don't seem to have these same problems with SmackDown, or NXT, or Lucha Underground, just Raw. As a matter of fact, why don't we just skip to SmackDown right now? Enough of this crap. SmackDown Live. I don't normally do polls for SmackDown like I do for Raw because I just don't. But I decided to do one this week. Raw was so bad. And this SmackDown show turned out to be so good. I said, let me throw a poll up and let's see the difference, right? Raw this week got 22% thumbs up. Let's see what SmackDown does. And you talk about night and day. So this poll got over 1,500 votes. 90% thumbs up. Only 10% thumbs down for SmackDown. Sounds about right. They set up a big main event for next week's show with AJ Styles defending the championship against Dolph Ziggler and Baron Corbin in a triple threat. I find Corbin more so than Ziggler as an opponent for Styles to be very intriguing. I don't know why, I just do, even though they're both heels. And also they're promoting the return of John Cena to TV next week. So setting up a big final SmackDown for 2016. On this show, AJ was back in action from the ankle injury. They finally had the match with him and James Ellsworth. They blew that whole fucking thing off. Thank God Styles did exactly what he should have done, which is kill Ellsworth dead in all of a minute, if that. Literally, like, I think he punched him in the face or something and pinned him. That was it. And then he killed him some more outside the ring. He dropped him across the announce desk. He suplexed him into the barricade. This was a decisive end to this feud. At long last, this thing had long run its course. And the crowd cheered this, by the way. They were very happy to see their champion beat the piss out of this guy. Apollo Crews took most of the offense in his match with The Miz, which is a good sign, I guess. But Miz still beat him. Eye poke, followed by a skull-crushing finale for the win. The real news here wasn't so much that Apollo Crews had a match, although that was kind of news. The real news came after the match, when Renee Young got into the ring to interview Miz. She asked, "What is your obsession with Dean Ambrose?" And The Miz, in response, said, "My obsession? Why don't we talk about your obsession with Dean Ambrose?" And the crowd was loving it. It was almost like a Jerry Springer moment. They're like, ooh, like the crowd loved that. But then The Miz followed that up with, "After all, you're the one sleeping with him." And Renee was so appalled by this, she slapped Miz in the face and walked out. First time we've ever seen Renee Young involved in an angle like this before. Aside from Total Divas, I think this was the first time on TV they even acknowledged that she has a relationship going with Dean Ambrose. It's kind of the same thing with Cena and Nikki. I really don't think it was until after the brand split that they acknowledged on the main shows on TV that Cena and Nikki were an item. So it's funny, you know, you look at what they did on this show, and I'm going to get to Nikki and Natalya in a second, and this segment, and then finally acknowledging Cena and Nikki. One of the things I like about SmackDown, whoever's writing SmackDown, I think one of the main writers for SmackDown supposedly is the guy who used to write for NXT, so maybe I shouldn't be surprised. But they do, I mean, it is still a Vince McMahon production, but they do have distinctly different writing teams for the shows. And I think I read that the Road Dogg might also be part of creative on SmackDown now. One of the things about the show that I like, they definitely seem more apt to inject reality into the show. And I feel like they're doing more of that. Again, these are things that were never acknowledged before that all of a sudden are being acknowledged on TV and in some cases are playing into the storylines, and it's not like a lot of people don't already know that Cena and Nikki are an item. If, you know, if they watch Total Divas, then they know. If they follow them on Instagram, then they know. And it's the same thing with Renee and Dean, but now they're finally bringing it out into the forefront, and they're injecting it into the storylines, and I like that. And that's not something that we really see very often on Raw. So I think that's one of the advantages that the team on SmackDown has, is that they like to tap into that whole reality aspect a little more. And wrestling is always better to me when you inject some more reality into things. So it's pretty clear the crowd already knew about their relationship. That's why they reacted to it the way they did. I like this. Miz came off as such a slime ball. And for, I think for her part, Renee played her role very well. I love it when, you know, I just, the thing about Renee, she is one of the most like real people that they have. When I watch her on Talking Smack and I watch her in even on the pre-shows and stuff, she's not the same kind of robotic announcer, like on-air talking head that you normally get on these shows. Like I mentioned before, when Jerry Lawler was on the pre-shows, it was only a matter of time. I mean, he just looked like he was completely checked out. You know, with Renee, she just comes off as real. She comes off as very likable. Yeah, I asked my friend and his wife, they watch Total Divas. I gave up on that, you know, a long time ago, as you guys know. So I know that Renee is part of the new season, but we were talking about something the other day, and he mentioned Renee. She came up in the conversation, and he said, you know, Renee Young is the most likable person on that show. I don't doubt it. I mean, she's a pretty girl, but she's just, there's something about her that's just very real and very likable. She's a big asset to that company. You know, there was a rumor a while back that ESPN was interested in picking her up. I don't know what her contract situation is like. I know she's a big wrestling fan, a big WWE fan. Maybe she doesn't want to leave. But if I'm WWE, you know, when her contract comes due, when her contract is getting close to the end there, I'm making a big pitch to do what I need to do to keep her. Because I think if they ever lost her, I think it'd be a big loss for them. I really do. But it'd be a great pickup for ESPN. I think ESPN has taken enough of the WWE people. They should leave Renee alone. Let us have Renee. You want to take somebody, take Tom Phillips or take David Otunga. Just leave her alone. We're not done, though, with all the shooting on this show. We had Carmella coaxing Natalya into finally admitting that it was indeed her who attacked Nikki Bella at Survivor Series, so no big swerve. It's not Eva Marie. It's not someone new like Mickie James, who is coming to SmackDown soon. It was, in fact, Natalya who attacked Nikki. I believe Natalya's exact words were, "All right, I did it, you bitch." Getting catty here on this show. Then later she called her a nothing, said, "That's why John will never marry you." Them are fighting words. Ambrose beat Luke Harper, but was beaten down by the Wyatts after the match and left for dead. Miz came out to pick the bones and laid him out with a skull-crushing finale. So Dean Ambrose is just making enemies left and right here. He's coming off the feud with Styles. He got screwed out of the championship by James Ellsworth. Now the Wyatts are beating him down. The Miz comes out. He's beating him down. Talking smack to his girlfriend. He's making a lot of enemies here on this show. Alexa Bliss had been feigning a knee injury, constantly ducking Becky Lynch. Daniel Bryan announced that Alexa would be defending the championship next week against Becky, but for tonight, she would have a different opponent, and if she refused to compete, she would be stripped of her championship. Turned out to be a masked wrestler calling herself La Luchadora, in a blue bodysuit and a purple mask, and La Luchadora got the submission win with Becky's disarmor. And she unmasked to reveal herself to be Becky Lynch. I actually thought this was really well done. I really do. I mean, how they pulled this whole thing off, it didn't really become too obvious until the very end. I mean, I knew. But, you know, sometimes it's just patently obvious who the other person is. And, you know, she was trying to wrestle a different style, and the crowd was chanting CCC, so that was funny. And she pulled the mask off in the end, and Alexa was appalled, and next week they will wrestle for the championship. So there's another big match they've set up for the show next week. Ziggler and Corbin were in the main event with the idea that if Ziggler lost, he would lose his championship match with Styles. because he's an idiot. So, because Daniel Bryan gave him an out. He said, look, you don't have to do this. And Ziggler's like, I have to. It's like, what a moron. What a moron. So they had a match, and it went to a double countout. Shitty finish, I think, to do after a long match like the one they had. But it was done to set things up with Styles for next week. AJ was out there doing commentary. He destroyed the two of them with chair shots when the match was over. So it was a strong week for the WWE Champion. He comes out of this show looking good, looking strong. He finished off Ellsworth. He left these two guys laying with chair shots to end the show. The thing is, though, even though he had the match, if you could call it that, with Ellsworth, he still has not taken a bump. He has not taken a bump since the ankle injury. And so I don't know if we're out of the woods yet or not. That ankle still worries me. Hopefully he's ready. Hopefully he's okay. I guess we'll see how he looks this week. But as for SmackDown this week, this was a fine show.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
Tony the Tiger Boylan, Rolex Robin Party, The Fast Blast, Tim Banks, Jonathan Killjoy Keane, Edwin Pretty Boy Palenzuela, the Chapel Hill High Flyer Kyle George, and Massgrave Micah Harshaw. Thank you guys for your PayPal support this week. NXT this week, they actually aired the Authors of Pain squash on this show with the enhancement guy who got hurt. It was John, I think, Ortegan, and Anthony Bowens, I believe, were their names. I think it was Bowens who got hurt when his partner got powerbombed onto him. I think the back of his partner's head smacked right into his face. You could tell right away the dude was just completely out of it. They picked him up. They went for their finish, which is the clothesline leg sweep combo. The guy could barely stand up straight. Credit to the referee. He saw this right away when the one Author of Pain hit the ropes and was about to come off for the finish. He jumped in the way. It's like a Secret Service agent. He dove in the way to take the bullet for this guy. He stopped him. Then he went and checked on Bowens. And then he waved off the match. So Authors of Pain win by ref stoppage. I like that they aired this. I don't know how smart it was, if this could be used as evidence down the road for something. I'm kind of surprised that they aired it. But I'm happy they did, because what it does is it just shows how destructive these two guys can be. It really did look like just bad positioning more than anything else. It looked like bad positioning more than anything overly inept that the two of them did, like overly reckless. I know they're still green and all, but look, I mean, accidents happen. Hopefully that's the only one. But it did make them seem like two walking wrecking machines, which is what you want them to come off as. The main event went at least 20 minutes. I didn't time it, but it was long. So a long match it was to crown a new number one contender for the NXT Championship, the winner to meet Shinsuke Nakamura, the next TakeOver show in San Antonio, Bobby Roode, Ty Dillinger, Roderick Strong, and Andrade Cien Almas. This was a really good match. Almas had a chance to shine for a little bit before being the first one eliminated. He had just hit the double knees in the corner on Dillinger. He was pulling him out when Roddy caught him with a sick kick and pinned him. Dillinger later on hit the tiebreaker on Roddy and pinned him, and so it came down to Ty Dillinger and Bobby Roode, bringing it right back to their feud. If you remember, they had a feud going. They had the big match in Toronto that Bobby Roode won, and ever since then, Ty Dillinger has been just doubting himself, and I thought they told a great story here. Again, here's Dillinger, a guy who stopped believing in himself after the loss to Roode. He was ready to quit a few weeks ago when he walked into William Regal's office, and Regal gave him the chance to be part of this match and earn a title match. And here he is. The fans are chanting his name. They want him badly to get that win over Bobby Roode. Tons of near falls for Ty Dillinger, including hitting a tiebreaker on Roode for a very close two count. In the end, Roode pinned him with the implant DDT, but this was easily Bobby Roode's best match and best showing to date in NXT. Dillinger looked great too, I thought, but it will in fact be Bobby Roode, to no one's surprise, I think, challenging Nakamura for the championship next month. This match made the entire show, as it should have, since it literally took up half the show. This was great stuff. Now, the next 2 weeks of NXT television are going to be two-hour episodes. This Wednesday is going to be the show that they had taped from Osaka, Japan, which had the title change between Joe and Nakamura. I believe they're replaying that, but they're also going to be showing a match. It's going to be Tajiri and Tozawa against DIY, and Asuka defending the Women's Championship against Nia Jax. So that'll be airing this week. Excuse me. And then the following week, they're airing at least part of, if not the entire show, from Melbourne, Australia that they taped. That had the cage match between Joe and Nakamura, which I believe they're going to replay again. And also Asuka against Peyton Royce and DIY against TM61. So that's kind of cool. You know, they went on location. They went to these different places. They taped full shows. And now we're going to get to see them. So that'll be the next. And I like that better than the usual, like, year-end clip shows. Normally, NXT will do, like, a year-in-review type show. I mean, that's fine, but it's very missable. These are two shows that I'm going to go out of my way to watch. And then when they come back, I believe on the 11th, we are going to get the rematch between DIY and The Revival for the Tag Team Championship, which is sounds great to me, considering that their two matches at TakeOver this year were two of the top 10 matches of the year, so I can't wait to see it. Kind of know what the outcome's already going to be. I don't see The Revival winning the belt and then defending against two other heels. But I suppose if they wanted to, they could do some kind of a disputed finish where it turns into a three-way tag match at the next TakeOver show. They could always do that. Get the Revival involved. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, thank you for your donation, as well as the Montreal Mauler, Patrick Pacheco, the Durham Destroyer, Christopher Doyle, Downtown, Kenneth Brown, Anthony Gorilla Press Gonzalez, and Danger Dan Kincaid. Thank you very much for the support. You guys are awesome. Lucha Underground. We had former WCW champion in attendance in the crowd this week for Lucha Underground. One David Arquette was shown in the crowd a few times. I remember reading that David Arquette's a big wrestling fan, always was. And I remember reading there was some kind of interview that he did, and he said that he was a fan of Lucha Underground. And he even once pitched the idea to the producers of the show. He wanted to be part of the show. Which, at first, you hear, hey, David Arquette wants to come to Lucha Underground, your heart kind of sinks. But he pitched this idea that he was going to be a drunken manager on the show. Which actually wouldn't be so bad. He'd probably fit right in there. As long as he doesn't wrestle. Can't be any worse than a drunken writer putting the title on him. We had the Mac beating PJ Black, Jeremiah Crane, and they call him Cage in the finals of Dario Cueto's Battle of the Bulls tournament. It was also an elimination match to crown a new number one contender, just like NXT was this week. Although Lucha Underground has their stuff taped months in advance at this point. So if anybody copied off anybody, and I'm not saying they did, it's the other way around. Cage was running wild in there until Tejano came out, hit him in the head with a bull rope. Prick. These two are still in the middle of a best of five series that may never end. Everyone hit their finish on Cage at that point and pinned him, so Cage was the first man gone. Crane, Jeremiah Crane that is, he was out next after a super stunner from the Mac. But I continue to be impressed by Jeremiah Crane. Every time I see him out there, it's like a new man. It's like, again, where was this guy in NXT? He'd still be there. So he was gone, came down to the back and PJ Black, and he had a stunner on him and got the win. So the Mac is now in line for a shot at the Lucha Underground Championship. Later on, the Mac was backstage with his friend, Sexy Star, and was kind of talking to her about the fact that, you know, if you win the title back tonight, it'll be you and me for the championship. So they were kind of kidding around about that. As they walked off together, we saw a comically fake spider scurrying across the floor. Oh my god, this thing looks so ridiculous. This looked like one of those furry spiders that you'd hang in like a window display. So bad. So bad. But like, comically bad. Backstage, we find Aerostar and Phoenix looking for their partner Drago. Where else? In the bathroom. It's a pretty safe bet if you're in Lucha Underground that if you're looking for Drago, he's probably in the bathroom. How many backstage skits have we seen with him in there anyway? This time he's nowhere to be found. If you remember, Cobra Moon and her lizard tribesmen kidnapped him last week. I doubt very seriously they took him to the bathroom. And if they did, I definitely don't want to know why or what happened in there. Cobra Moon suddenly appears. She's got no business being in the men's room, but there she is. And her two henchmen show up to attack Phoenix and Aerostar. This long brawl breaks out. This is like a long fight sequence out of a bad B action movie. Although I guess you can probably say that about most of Lucha Underground. That's what makes it different. In the end, Aerostar and Phoenix are left laying on the bathroom floor, which all of you guys know, the floor of a public men's room is the last place that you want to be laying. Or the toilets, right? It's like, I don't want to get disgusting here with you, but depending on what it is that I have to do, I would rather hold it in until it starts leaking out of my friggin' ears than use a public toilet. Maybe it's just me. I have a thing for that. Jeremiah Crane, meanwhile, is in Dario Cueto's office asking for a match next week against who we don't know. But Dario grants him his wish, and then, very weird, he grabs, I think, a chair. He climbs up on the chair, and Dario's like, what are you doing? And he pushes the tile up from the ceiling, and he's fishing around for something in the ceiling. And he grabs some kind of a wooden board, has some kind of writing or inscription on it, and he leaves with it. He walks out with it. And so in the hallway, he bumps into Katrina. And he shows her the board and he says, hey, do you remember this? This is from like all those years ago. What it was doing in Dario's roof, I have no idea. And then he tells her that next week, I've got a match with your man, Mil Muertes, who he calls by his real name. Raul Mendoza or something like that. And he says that when I'm done with him, Mil's going to wish he would have died in that earthquake when he was a kid. And then I will have you all to myself. Hey now, you back off there, buddy. Johnny Mundo and Sexy Star steel cage match for the Lucha Underground Championship. A lot of fighting up top, a lot of scurrying to try to get out of the cage, escape the cage. And it ended with Johnny Mundo desperate to just win this match. He grabs Sexy Star's mask and rips it right off her head and throws it down to the mat. And so Sexy falls down to the mat. She is doing everything she can to shield her face from being seen. And that allowed Mundo to escape the cage and retain the championship. I actually like that finish. I think it drives home what an asshole Johnny Mundo is. And that he's willing to do anything to keep his title. It's kind of like The Miz, ironically enough, right? Mundo and Miz, they have a history together. And I think a lot of their, a lot of their characters now are kind of marrying each other in terms of them being the chicken shit heel. So as he's backing up the staircase to go leave, he's holding up his championship. He's so proud of himself for what he just did. The Mac comes back out. He lays out Mundo with a stunner and poses with the championship. And so ends this chapter of Sexy Star fighting for the Lucha Underground title. Thank God. Or at least one can hope. I shouldn't say that. She may end up getting another title shot down the line. Who the hell knows? The show ended with Drago being chained to the wall. We see him chained to the wall in Cobra Moon's lair. And she says, are you ready to kneel before me? And he says, never. She says, well, you must be awfully hungry. And Drago says, I'd rather starve. So she laughs and she walks away. And then for some reason, Drago gets this look on his face like he suddenly has gas. And then he breathes fire, like an actual dragon. Maybe he had heartburn. And that's what happens when a dragon gets heartburn, I don't know. But that's how they went off the air. I am not really digging this Drago stuff at all. So that was Lucha Underground. I saw an item in the Observer this week that kind of worried me. It was about the morale behind the scenes among the talent in Lucha Underground being not very high at the moment. And the talent apparently were under the impression that they'd be taping for a fourth season by now. And they have been told that taping may not start until next October. That's a long delay. It's pretty crazy also for people who are signed to 7-year contracts, right? I mean, many of them are supposedly signed to 7-year deals. There might be some exceptions. Obviously, somebody like Prince Puma may have been, let out of his contract or had a shorter deal because I think he's gone. But you know, a lot of these people signed those 7-year deals when they first signed on. And I assume that as you delay taping, you delay the contract. So that's not a good thing. But it worries me because, you know, they're talking about a season four. Is it going to happen? Yes, it's going to happen. We're going to start taping. And then you hear, well, the taping's delayed for a year. And you worry, is there even going to be a season four? We seem to go through these questions every single time we come to the end of a season. But they are taped until June. I believe they are taped through June of next year. So we've got plenty of Lucha Underground in the can on TV for the next several months. So we won't have to be without it. But I am worried about the future. And finally here, rounding out our PayPal donations for this week, I want to say thank you to Quicksilver, Quentin Gayhart Kasinger, the Pembroke Kid, Jason Allen, Headcase, Hansel Peralta, the Shooter, Ryan Stingle, the Victor Brown Show, and Victor would like to wish everybody in the Facebook group a Merry Christmas, including his brother Cedric Brown, and Vinny Minetti. So thank you to everybody who made a donation this week. Again, you can always do so on thesolemonster.com. The PayPal link is on the right-hand side. You are obligated to do nothing. It is entirely voluntary, entirely up to you, but this was a great year in terms of your donations and your support. Biggest year yet. I can't thank you enough for that. And I just wanted to take a moment here to say thank you once again. All right. Santa Solomonster is here to answer your questions here. As I reach into my giant sack of questions, that is, for the mailbag. You can always email questions to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. This first letter comes from Amy from Mumbai, India. Pitch your final four for the Royal Rumble at the Alamo Dome. Well, I thought about this after I pulled Amy's question. The way I look at it is this. Brock Lesnar and Bill Goldberg are two of the bigger attractions in the Rumble match this year. They're having a match at WrestleMania. And they're getting rid of each other in this match. I don't know if they tumble over at the same time. I don't know if Goldberg eliminates Brock and Brock ends up costing him and pulling him out of the ring. Whenever, however, they're going out. Okay, so they kind of cancel each other out. I don't expect them to be there at the end. So you take them out of the picture. Undertaker may well be in the Royal Rumble match. I would rather see him and AJ Styles for the championship on that show. But you gotta get Undertaker on that card in some form or fashion. They're in Texas. You know, WrestleMania will no longer define my legacy. And then he vanishes again. It's like, what the hell's up with that? So let's say he's on the card, but not in this match, okay? I propose this for a final four. Let me get your thoughts on this. My final four would be Samoa Joe, who I do think is going to debut in that match. John Cena. I'd love to see Joe and Cena in there throwing down, even if just for a few minutes. Braun Strowman, who they're pushing to the moon lately. And Sami Zayn. So Joe, Cena, Strowman, and Zayn would be my final four. The way I see it, Cena dumps Joe. Strowman dumps Cena. Because you know they're going to want to give Strowman a big elimination, probably a whole bunch of them. And then he turns his attention to Zayn. And it comes down to Braun Strowman and Sami Zayn. I have to think that this Strowman-Zayn stuff is leading to something. And if they don't want Sami to pin the guy, and I'm not sure I would. I'm not sure I would have Sami Zayn pin Braun Strowman. Braun Strowman is the big unstoppable monster. I don't know that he should be pinned by Sami Zayn. But if they don't want him to decisively beat the Giant, he just got that kind of fluky win. Oh, I lasted 10 minutes. That means I won. Okay, sure. If they don't want to beat the Giant decisively in a match straight up, then why not just tell the David versus Goliath story in the Rumble instead? Now, I know they did the same thing with Benoit and Big Show, but that was 12 years ago. And if they stretch this thing out to the Rumble, I mean, Strowman was on a rampage on Monday night. He was looking for Sammy. Foley said he's not here. He's 100 miles away. If we are to assume that this is not the end of the whole Strowman-Sammy thing, if they want to drag this out, the story will have been playing itself out by that point on TV for a good 2 months leading up to this moment. Zayn finds a way to pull out the win and slay the Giant, and Sami Zayn wins the Royal Rumble. That is my pick. My pick for the Rumble winner is Sami Zayn. And the big payoff to this feud, the payoff to Sammy being destroyed by this man, and all this talk about how you can't do it, you're the underdog and all that kind of stuff. And in the end, Sammy pulls it out. I have to say, though, I do find it weird that they did the swerve on TV with Mick Foley where he was going to trade Sammy because he wouldn't give him the match. And then Sammy kind of just went nuts on him. And Foley's like, see, I wanted to motivate you. I always believed in you. And only for him to come out, though, at the pay-per-view waving the white towel, which just runs completely counter to the story that they just told on TV. All of a sudden, Foley doesn't believe in him again. You know, it's not like Sammy was laying on the floor a bloody mess or something, and you're like, yeah, you know what, Foley probably should come out and throw in the towel. It just was very weird to see them do that. But that is the story that for weeks and weeks and weeks they were telling. And so I think the people like Sammy enough to buy into him winning, and I think that you keep the title on Kevin Owens long enough to do Zayn and Owens for the Universal title of WrestleMania. I know they had that throwaway match on TV about a month or so ago, and Owens just beat him, but they've mostly kept these two apart since Battleground. Battleground was their best match by far, and at Battleground, they had Sammy winning the match, seemingly the big kind of blow-off or payoff to the feud. Sammy actually won the feud, and it was Owens who went on to win the championship the month after, and meanwhile, Sammy was just, you know, there for months and months with nothing to do until the Strowman thing came along. So there's a story there, too, if they want to tell it. But, you know, Zayn, I think, would also be kind of a surprise pick. I don't know that too many people necessarily have him picked to win. I think to enough people, I don't know that they would expect a Sami Zayn win coming out of this match. And what that then allows you to do, if Sami Zayn wins, and on the Raw side for WrestleMania now is taken care of. It's going to be Zayn and Owens, let's say, for the Universal title, okay? What it allows you to do is set up either John Cena or The Undertaker, or I should say John Cena and The Undertaker, not or The Undertaker, for WrestleMania. Because I think that's still the big match that you get to. I think Cena and Undertaker, it's a match they've wanted to do before and it's never worked out. And we haven't even seen these guys in a singles match going back over a decade. It's been long enough. Taker's, you know, nearing the end. I think it allows you to do that match at WrestleMania. And that would be the real main event. I mean, Sami Zayn and Kevin Owens, I'm looking at these matches on this pay-per-view. Even if they do wrestle, frankly, I think whatever the Universal title match is, it ain't going on last. So, yeah, Sami Zayn is going to the main event of WrestleMania, but not really, okay? Cena and Undertaker, if they do that match, that is the main event. Whether it's for the championship or not, that is the main event. And you could do... You actually have two options here. You could keep the championship on AJ Styles and let AJ go all the way to Mania with it and do Cena-AJ on that show with Cena getting number 16, getting his big win, because, you know, Styles is 3-0 against him. At some point, you know he ain't going 4-0. Let's just be honest here, okay? Even if you don't like John Cena, you can kind of see where this is going. And so they could just blow the whole thing off with one final match between them at WrestleMania. Or maybe not final, because AJ would get a rematch at some point. But Cena gets his big moment. He finally gets that monkey off his back. He couldn't beat Styles. Now he finally does, and he ties Ric Flair. And I'm sure people will be all pissed off about it, but you know what? Too bad. Because it's going to happen whether you like it or not. You may as well just accept it. So SmackDown has two potential big main events for WrestleMania that they could set up, both of which happen to involve John Cena. Cena Styles or Cena Undertaker. I saw an interview with Finn Balor recently where he said, because if you remember, I mentioned Balor. Somebody had asked me like a month or two ago, like really, really early, who do I think is the early favorite to win the Rumble? And I said, well, if he can make it back in time, it would be Finn Balor. Because I could see him coming out as a surprise, as the demon, the big demon entrance in the Alamo Dome. And he wins. And if Kevin Owens is still the champion, Finn Balor never actually lost the title. They could tell that story. He goes to Mania. He wins back the championship. Then I saw the interview with Finn Balor that he did recently, where he said he is optimistic that he will be back before WrestleMania, or like just in time for WrestleMania. He said the Rumble, not impossible, looking a lot less likely though. Now I know we've been down this road before, John Cena tore his pec, should have been out a lot longer than he was, and all of a sudden there he is in the Rumble. Anything can happen. Maybe they're swerving us. I don't know that that's the case here. And when you're dealing with a shoulder injury, I mean, that's a serious thing. You know, you got to let that thing heal. Poor Hideo Itami had shoulder surgery, and I guess it didn't heal right, and the guy ended up having a second surgery, and he was out for a year and a half. You never know. You don't chance stuff like that. So I take him at his word that the likelihood of Balor being a surprise in the Rumble is slim to none, and so that takes him out of the picture, and that's what got me thinking about Sami Zayn. And so all of a sudden, the Mania picture begins to become a little bit clearer. Like I said, Owens and Zayn. Cena wins the Elimination Chamber match and gets a championship opportunity against either AJ or The Undertaker at WrestleMania. You've got Lesnar and Goldberg. I think that match is a lock. You've got Rollins and Triple H. That match is pretty much a lock. And if Samoa Joe is on the main roster by then, and I see him as a Raw guy anyway when he comes up, for some reason, I see Nakamura whenever it is that he comes up being a SmackDown guy, and I see Joe as a Raw guy. You could do Joe and Roman Reigns. You know, I don't know if Roman will still be U.S. champ by that point or not, if it'll be a title match. It doesn't have to be. But I could see a Joe-Roman, you know, kind of undercard match at WrestleMania. And there you go. I mean, you've got your top five matches right there, if that's how things play out for WrestleMania. And I don't think that that's a bad top of the card at all. Robbie from Dundee, Scotland. If Jerry Lawler does sign a talent deal, he would likely be a manager. Do you think this would be a good idea? And who would you have him manage? Yeah, he made that comment in an interview that he did where he said he might sign a talent deal for next year. He's going to have discussions with WWE. I can't see that as being a wrestler. So manager, I would say, is a possibility. And, you know, it's not that I don't think Lawler wouldn't make a good mouthpiece for some heel on the roster. I just don't know that WWE knows how to really use managers anymore, especially when they bring these legends back. It's like, look what happened with Bob Backlund and Darren Young. That went nowhere. What a waste that's been. Paul Ellering at NXT, I mean, they've done a better job with. It makes sense to have him with the Authors of Pain because I haven't heard those guys speak a lick of English yet, although it's not like Ellering's really had much to say either. But at least Triple H seems to know how to book an old-school manager. Vince apparently doesn't think they're of much use anymore, which I think he's dead wrong on. But if that's how he feels, then how effective can Lawler really be as a manager on the main roster? Plus, he's 67 years old. Are they going to let him take bumps? I don't doubt that he could. I think he still wrestles on the weekends, but are they going to let him? Of course not. I don't know that it would work. A lot of it depends on how committed they are to it. I took a look at the rosters. I went through the Raw roster, the SmackDown roster, and the NXT roster. I wanted to look at this and see who would jump out at me as someone, a heel, whoever. Who I look at and say, you know what, this guy would be a good fit for Jerry Lawler. Or this is somebody who could benefit from having someone like Lawler in their corner, maybe doing some of the talking for them. I went through all the rosters, and I'll be honest, I don't see anybody on Raw or SmackDown worth putting him with. Nobody jumped out at me. I just don't see a good fit there. Then I look at the NXT roster, and there's one guy who stands out to me as someone who I think could really benefit from having somebody like Lawler backing him up. And it'd be as a heel, and I know he's a babyface right now. He's got the whole Perfect 10 gimmick, and people love to chant along, and they probably still would, even after you turn him. They'll probably still do the whole 10 chant stuff, but I think putting Lawler with Ty Dillinger could be a really good thing for Ty Dillinger. You look at him in NXT, he's gotten over. He really has. I mean, you look at him in that four-way on the NXT show this past week. He fell short again to Bobby Roode, but people wanted that guy to win badly. They have found somebody in Ty Dillinger who they feel they can root for and get behind. And, yeah, the 10 thing is a great gimmick to have, but they genuinely seem to like this guy. So right now, he's got a great thing going, and I wouldn't do anything to mess with that. But he's also lost a whole bunch of big matches, right? To the point where a few weeks ago on TV, he was doubting whether or not he even belonged on the roster anymore. He looked like he was ready to quit, right? That was the whole storyline. Now imagine, if you would, the King shows up. And Lawler says, I've been watching you lately. I've had my eye on you. I see something in you that reminds me of some of the greats that I used to wrestle down in Memphis. Or whatever. Because Dillinger, the thing about Ty Dillinger, he's a very competent wrestler. And, you know, not for nothing, I think he talks pretty good too. I mean, he doesn't necessarily need someone to do the talking for him. But he never caught on as a major star. He had a little run as, was it Gavin Spears or whatever, when they rebooted ECW. That's how far back this guy goes. Then they let him go, then he came back, and he's just been toiling in developmental for so many years. And my fear for this guy is that, let's say he gets called up to the main roster. Let's say they count down to number 10 in the Royal Rumble match, and out comes Ty Dillinger to a big reaction. And in those initial weeks, the first month, even 2 months, the perfect 10 thing is just super over. And it even looks like he's in line for a push. Maybe he could even wrestle for the Intercontinental title. There's a natural feud there with The Miz because the two of them had a little Twitter feud going a few weeks ago. Miz was mocking the fact that this guy has spent 10 years off and on in developmental. Okay. When that feud runs dry, let's say they do all that. Okay, when that feud runs dry, after those first couple of months or so, the perfect 10 thing ain't going to be as over as it was when he walked in there on day one. Fandangoing, in case we all forgot, used to be a thing. Remember that? And that fizzled out, just like the perfect 10 thing is going to fizzle out. It's inevitable. But Ty Dillinger does not have to be a one-trick pony. You could debut him on the main roster, you could let him do his thing for a few months, and you can run the same angle that they were doing on NXT, where he starts to lose, he's down in the dumps, whatever, and then bring Lawler back to TV to help give the guy an edge. I mean, Lawler may be 67, and he may have been mailing it in my opinion, for a while there on headset, but he could still talk. And I think that he could do Dillinger a lot of good and maybe help prolong his push so that when the Perfect 10 thing fizzles out, he doesn't just end up in main event matches every week against Titus O'Neil or, you know, Jey Uso or what have you. Because I'm telling you, as good as the guy may be, you know, I always read a lot of praise for him from other people at NXT, what a great talent he is, and a lot of knowledge that he imparts on people. He may end up being a coach one day, okay? Tyler Breeze also got a lot of praise from people at NXT and was a very competent talent and got himself over. And now he is mired in mid-card hell with the other guy who got over for a while before it all fizzled out. They just put the two of them together. And they have a very entertaining, you know, mid-card tag team act. That's fine. I still maintain that Breeze had something as a singles heel and they just didn't, you know, they couldn't tap into that. I don't know if they didn't want to. Maybe the gimmick just wasn't going to get over on the main roster the way it did at Full Sail. That's also possible. But I think about him. He doesn't have to be a one-trick pony. That's the kind of person I think Jerry Lawler could potentially end up helping. And then Dillinger could end up as a solid, you know, in a solid mid-card heel spot on the roster. Amir from Blackburn in the UK. When Chris Jericho beat Triple H on the April 17, 2000 edition of Raw, do you think they made the right call giving the title back to Triple H later in the night, or do you think they should have allowed Jericho to run with the belt for a month or two? That was a great angle. That was one of the best angles that they've ever done on that show. The answer is no. I think it was too soon. Not that Jericho wasn't over. I mean, he was super over. You could do it for a month or two. I'm not saying you can't, but what's the point? You know what I mean? Like, Triple H had just broken through, finally, as a main event guy. I didn't really buy into him as a top-line guy until the feud with Foley a few months before this. So I think it would have been too soon to take him out of that spot. And the timing just wasn't right, because that was 6 days before the Rock-Triple H match at Backlash, where Rock won the championship. Right? They didn't do the title change at WrestleMania. They did it the month after. Austin had just come back. He got one of the... I mean, Austin, at Backlash, when Rock won that belt, he was supposed to be in Rock's corner. And then Austin never showed up, and you're wondering, oh, what did the McMahon-Helmsley regime do to him? Did they, you know... They locked him in a room somewhere. Where's Austin at? So, of course, at the most opportune moment, as The Rock is being beaten down, the glass shatters and out comes Austin. He obliterates everybody with a steel chair. He was only a few months removed from neck surgery. I think the month before he had only gotten out of his halo. So you could tell him moving around. I mean, he was kind of moving around stiff. He wasn't hitting a stunner on anybody. People were kind of making fun of him at the time. They're like, oh, it's Fat Austin, because he looked like he gained some weight. The fucking guy was sitting at home for 3 months after neck surgery. Give him a break, you know what I mean? You sit at home and drink beer for 3 months, you're going to gain some weight. But Austin came out and blew the roof off the place. To this day, that's probably still the biggest, longest, most sustained pop I've ever heard in my life. People just lost their minds when he walked out there. And from the moment he walked out there, he left, Rock hit the people's elbow, he won the championship. That was a great pay-per-view. That was a great main event, that was a great pay-per-view. But anyway, long story short, I'm guessing that they held off on the title change, by the way, at WrestleMania because Austin probably wasn't ready to come back. I'm assuming that's why they did that the way they did. But they gave the belt to The Rock. And so to all of a sudden appoint a completely new person, a babyface, to put the championship on him 6 days before The Rock was supposed to get the belt after he was chasing it for months, really wouldn't have made any sense. It would have totally screwed up their plans. Rock was the second hottest behind Austin, babyface in the entire company. You could argue that Jericho was number three. I mean, he was that popular at the time. But the timing just wasn't right. You know, you put the title on Jericho, either Rock is out or Triple H is out. One of them is taking a back seat. And those two were right in the prime of their feud. They were in the prime of their career. I wouldn't have done that. But I just thought the angle itself, the title change, they opened the show with that. I just thought as a ratings device even, it was fantastic the way they did that. It was very well done. Triple H had this little side feud going with Earl Hebner. It was Hebner who ended up screwing him over in that match and fast counting him. It gets this great reaction. People are so excited. And then to put heat back on Triple H, they have him bully the referee into giving him the championship back and admitting he made a mistake. And when he does, right, he does this on the condition that you will never put your hands on me so long as I'm a WWF referee. You have to promise me that. And they're like, sure, no problem. As soon as Triple H gets the belt back, he immediately fires him and says, well, I guess you're not a WWE referee anymore. And he beats his ass. It was great. And then later in the show, as great as the reaction was, that was actually a very memorable episode of Raw. As big as the reaction was to all of this and to Jericho winning the title, they had Linda McMahon, not the most exciting person in the world, come out and make the announcement that Austin was going to be back in The Rock's corner at Backlash. And the place, I'm shocked the arena didn't crumble to a pile of ash. I've never heard a pop so loud for a verbal announcement. He wasn't even there. Then Triple H and Shane and Stephanie came out in a huff. Steph goes to slap Linda. Stephanie's been very slap happy, you can see, for almost 20 years now. Linda slaps her instead. Stephanie tells Triple H to go pedigree my mom. Shane steps in to break it up. The Rock comes out. People are losing their minds. I mean, this is back when people were actually really over on this show. I know it's hard to believe, but they were. Raw, believe it or not, used to be the kind of show you never wanted to miss. I think even if they had DVR back then, Raw was the kind of show that you would have wanted to watch it live. You would not have wanted that show spoiled for you before you had a chance to see it. It's just, it's pretty incredible how times have changed. Isaac from London, Ontario. I remember watching clips of the biggest Monday Night Raw ever from February 1999 with over 40,000 people packed into the Toronto Sky Dome. I know wrestling is not as hot as it used to be, but do you think WWE should do another televised Raw or SmackDown from a large stadium in the future? Well, first of all, I think they'd be out of their friggin' minds to do SmackDown from a dome or a stadium. They have weeks where they can barely fill 5,000-seat buildings for SmackDown. That's how bad it is. And it's a shame because SmackDown, I think, has been far superior to Raw. But that just goes to show you how far name value will get you. I remember that Raw show. It looked cool. I think it was taped, right? I don't think it aired live. It looked cool with the giant screen in the background. I remember that screen from WrestleMania 6, the big Videotron. But the thing I remember most about that was the sea of signs. You got to remember from like the Attitude Era, everybody brought a sign to the building. And that's a 15,000-seat building. Now magnify that by a building that fits, I mean, it fits 60 or 70,000. They had 40,000. Just a sea of signs. They're like, holy shit, you couldn't even see people. You didn't see any actual, like, human flesh. It was just signs everywhere. It was amazing. Just go back and watch that show when it opened. They do this sweeping shot of the crowd. It's just signs everywhere. And then Austin comes out, and there's just this energy that, I mean, as a fan, I would kill to have that again every single week. But that was also a two-hour show at the peak of their popularity with Stone Cold Steve Austin on their roster. And very rowdy, very loud crowds. You know, now WWE is far from its peak in popularity. Their crowds are mostly comatose. And they have no Stone Cold Steve Austin on their roster. Not even close. So they're actually less popular. And yet the show is even longer. And it's filled with more talking and more commercial breaks. I just think it would be a bad idea to fill a dome for a Raw show. I mean, they could probably fit, I would say they could probably safely fit 20,000 plus in a big enough building if they promote, let's say, a big match or two far enough in advance. And then they could just darken a good part of the building to make it look more full than it really is. I have to say, you know, TNA was a master at that many years ago. That's the one thing I have to say about TNA is when it came to, when it came to having a show in a bigger building, which they sometimes did. In fact, I think they actually ran the Alamo Dome. I think they ran the Alamo Dome for a pay-per-view. Now, the Alamo Dome fits upwards of 70,000 people. Okay, for a TNA show there that drew under 10,000. It was probably more like 5 or 6. And yet I remember them doing a pretty good job of making it seem more full than it actually was. They were very good at that sort of thing for a while. They had to become master manipulators because they just didn't have the crowds. They just didn't have it. So they became good at that. But I personally, I wouldn't do it. I would not take Raw or SmackDown, put it in a big dome or a big building like that. Maybe if they could find a dome with a capacity of like 25,000 or 30,000 max. But any more than that, I just think it's going to be really embarrassing for them. By the way, I just noticed every single question I've answered so far is from someone outside the United States. They've all been international so far, which is cool. It's actually really cool, but I do have some people here. I'm gonna work in some of the American ones here. Although this next one, Jay from Roxbury, that's all it says. I don't know if Roxbury is in the U.S. or if there's a Roxbury in the U.K. or where that is, but. Jay says, maybe it's from the outer reaches of your mind, you know, like Damian Demento is from. But Jay says, Monsoon Heenan, Monsoon Ventura, J.R. Lawler, J.R. Heenan Savage. If you could move announce teams to another era, what would your preference be? Was J.R. Heenan and Savage a team? Oh, WrestleMania, that's right. Actually, what am I talking about? WrestleMania and King of the Ring, of course they were. I love that team at the King of the Ring. How could I forget that? What would I move them? What era would I move them to? Well, I'll tell you what. I would take any one of those today over what we have now. The thing is, though, I don't think it would matter. I really don't. I mean, the announcers now are so overproduced. They're produced so differently today than they were back then. And you got to remember hashtags and all this other nonsense. It wouldn't be the same. It would just be neutered. Can you imagine some of the jokes that Bobby Heenan used to make, how they would go over today? They'd go over like a lead balloon. I do think that Ventura and Vince, or Ventura and Monsoon, which is my second favorite announce combo over or behind Gorilla and Bobby, which is number one. My list, for those who don't know, is Monsoon Heenan number one, Ventura Monsoon number two, and JR and King number three. That's how they rank for me. You can't go wrong with any of those. I think, though, that Ventura with either one of those guys would probably do pretty okay because Jesse has always been... Jesse Ventura, I think, as an announcer, certainly, has always been a very pragmatic guy. I used to love it when Monsoon would call out the heels for cheating or for using a weapon. But then when Hogan or some other babyface would do the same thing, he would defend them. And Jesse would lose his mind. He'd be like, oh, so it's okay when Hogan does it, but not when, you know, Rick Rude does it. Like, you knew the guy was making sense, but Gorilla would just be like, well, that's how it goes, Jesse. It's like, the best, I know I've mentioned this before, but it's worth mentioning again. The best was the interaction with Jesse Ventura and Tony Schiavone during that Ultimate Warrior Rick Rude rematch at SummerSlam in 89. They were outside the ring. It was very early in the match. And Warrior has Rude outside the ring. And Warrior hits Rude with the Intercontinental belt. He just grabs the belt and hits him with it. And the referee saw the whole thing. And Jesse is just completely exasperated. He's like, that should be a disqualification. Why isn't the referee disqualifying the Warrior for using an illegal foreign object? And Schiavone explains. He's like, well, Jesse, you know, they're outside the ring. So it's okay. And Jesse, he's just getting angrier and angrier and angrier, and he goes, well, what's that supposed to mean, that you could just do whatever you want if you're outside the ring? Does that mean I could take out a gun and shoot someone as long as it's outside the ring? Makes it okay? You're even dumber than Monsoon, and I thought he was the stupidest man alive. It's just, again, everything he's saying makes total sense. It was so great. And that's not even a knock on Tony Schiavone. I think Tony Schiavone was a good announcer when he was in WWE. It's a shame he didn't stick around longer, but I guess he just wanted to move back to Georgia. You know, his family was used to living down there, and the kids that he had and everything. And that's why he didn't get fired. He made a decision that he wanted to go back down to Atlanta, because he was only there for like maybe a year, year and a half at the most. So I enjoyed him, but Jesse was great. Jesse was just fantastic. And I do think that that could still work today. I really don't think you're going to get Jesse Ventura to conform to all of this nonsense and bullshit that they have the announcers doing now. I think he'd be his own man. Corey Graves, I think, has some of that in him. I think Corey Graves is probably the closest thing we've got to a Jesse Ventura type. Byron Saxton is completely useless, as is David Otunga. And JBL is just annoying. Ben from Fresno, what are your thoughts on CM Punk giving away his WWE title for free? I thought it was the nicest thing I've heard CM Punk do since he bought Joey Mercury a house. Santa Punk, you know, 'tis the season. He's in the holiday spirit. For those who don't know, Cliff Compton, who used to be Domino in WWE, he went on Twitter, he posted a picture of what he claims to be CM Punk's actual WWE title belt. That I think it's the one that he won for the first time in 2011. They either gave it to him or gave him a replica of it or what have you. And he claims that he was, you know, I guess he's friends with Punk, and he was going through Punk's storage unit, and he found the title. It was very dusty, and he thought it was cool, so he showed it to Punk, and Punk just said, "It's yours. Merry Christmas." And Compton said now he's going to give it to his 9-year-old nephew, which I think is really cool. I have no problem with it at all. I mean, are there really people out there who were upset by this? Are these people for real? I'm not talking about you, Ben, but I saw Compton replying to tweets almost defending Punk. Like, no, it's just who he is. It's fine. It's cool. Like, why even engage with these people? It's such a ridiculous thing to get upset about. Like, it's the man's property. He can do whatever he wants with it. It's not like he ran it over with his car. He didn't take a dump on it. He didn't toss it into the fireplace. I'm kind of surprised he hasn't. He was sitting in a storage unit collecting dust. And now some little kid is going to get to enjoy it. Leave the man alone. There's nothing wrong with it. Brian from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Tommy Dreamer revealed in an interview that he was paid $7,000 to drink Undertaker's tobacco spit juice while in the ring with him on Raw back in 02 during Taker's Big Evil phase. And I remember thinking at the time that was the grossest thing I have ever seen in wrestling. What is the grossest thing that you have ever seen in pro wrestling? Well, that would definitely be one of them. I think even Undertaker was grossed out and almost upchucked in the ring. You'd have to pay me a lot more than $7,000 to do something like that. Like, throw some more zeros on there. And honestly, I'm still not sure I'd be able to do it. It's like, oh, well, if you paid me $1 million, I would do it. I think once you get me in the ring and I'm standing there with the cup in my hand, I don't know that I could actually do that. But I'll do you one better. That is not the most disgusting thing I've ever seen in wrestling. I already know the answer. I'm going to say the grossest thing I have ever seen was on an episode of Raw back in 98. This was right before that Highway to Hell SummerSlam that they did at the Garden. I don't know if it was the week before or 2 weeks or whatever it was. Tiger Ali Singh. Remember Tiger Ali Singh? You may not. He didn't last very long. But he was doing the old million-dollar man gimmick where he would offer someone cash from the crowd to come in and perform a task, and it would be really demeaning. He was trying to prove a point that for enough money, you can get an American to do anything when you ask them to. And he got one fan, I will never forget this, although I wish I could, to come into the ring, and I think it was for like $500 or something. He had the guy lick the toe jam from between the toes of his manservant, Babu. He said Babu has not washed his feet for days. He pulled the sock off, and they put some kind of shit between the guy's toes to make it look like toe jam, whatever the hell toe jam looks like. And this guy, this fan, did not hesitate. He didn't even pretend like, oh, I don't want to do this. He had a smile on his face. He couldn't wait to get down on his hands and knees. And he started licking between this guy's toes. Oh my God. I'm starting to dry heave just thinking about it. Oh God. Jesus Christ. Fucking wrestling fans. I love them, but some of them are just out of their fucking minds. I know Tiger got hurt later on, and he sued WWE, and I don't know what happened after that. But to me, though, this is the grossest thing I have ever seen, besides the last few years of Raw. Brandon from Sevierville, Tennessee. Who do you think was the best transitional WWE champion? Personally, I think Kane's win over Steve Austin and subsequent loss has to be a top contender. I mean, that, it depends on how you define a great transitional champion, right? I mean, it's such a nebulous concept. I mean, great can mean different things to different people. Are we talking great in terms of great angle, great matches, that it led to great things for the person who won it? I mean, the Kane thing in 98 was really cool because that's the Kane that I love the most, like the original monster Kane. And I think he should have had a longer run with the belt. Maybe not then because Austin was so hot as a babyface, but at some point, and he never did. It was a great angle. It led to a monster rating the next night on Raw, which is exactly, that's the whole reason why they did it. That's the only reason they did that. Got like a 6.0. But I wouldn't say Kane was a great transitional champion. In fact, I don't even consider Kane to be a transitional champion. Not for that run, because I've always understood a transitional champion to be somebody who's there to get the belt off one person and get it onto a different person. Hence the whole transition. Here, Kane beat Austin for it, and then he dropped it right back to Austin 24 hours later. There was never any actual transition. So Kane doesn't count. If I had to pick somebody, there's two names that come to mind for me. One is the Iron Sheik, and the other is The Rock. I think you can't go wrong with either one of those guys, right? Sheik, look what Sheik did. Sheik ended a 6-year run, or 5.5 years, whatever it was, that Bob Backlund had with that belt. Bob Backlund had a stranglehold on that championship for almost 6 years, and Sheik was the first guy to beat him. And he only beat him for one purpose, and that was to get the belt off of Backlund and anoint their brand new top babyface, Vince Jr.'s top babyface, that being Hulk Hogan. That was the only reason that the Sheik got the belt. He only had it for like a month. But they weren't going to have Hogan beat Backlund for it, so we'll have the evil Iranian beat this American hero here, and then drop it to our new American hero. That is the definition of a transitional champion. And then you look at what happened after the fact. I mean, that kicked off the whole Hulkamania run in WWE. I think that Hogan guy turned out pretty well after that. Now, Rock had a lot of championship runs, but Rock won the title in that great triple threat match with Undertaker and Kurt Angle. which was in the summer of 2002. It was in July. And the only reason he won it was to drop it right back to Brock Lesnar the next month at SummerSlam. That was their first meeting. Brock was the new guy. He was the rookie on the ascent. And he lost the championship to him, clean as a whistle, right in the middle of the ring at SummerSlam. And that is the definition of a transitional champion. And that was huge for Brock's career. All those top guys, Undertaker, even Hogan on SmackDown with a bear hug, those guys put Brock over like $1 million. Best rookie year for anybody in WWE. And, you know, he went on to beat a whole bunch of guys. But they worked very hard to get Brock over as the next big thing. The whole next big thing was not just a catchphrase. It was real. That's what they wanted him to be. That's why they were so pissed when he gave his notice and said, I'm leaving. I'd probably go with Rock on this. It's not the only time he was a transitional champion. I mean, he did the same thing with John Cena in 2013. He beat CM Punk for the belt, only to lose it to Cena at WrestleMania. That one was not as good as the other transition. Wes from Greenville, buy or sell on what has a better chance of happening in the next couple of years? The Elite, Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks against the New Day, or the Broken Hardys against the New Day? Broken Hardys against New Day. I would sell on the Elite. And finally here, Jared from Maryland. Buy or sell on the greatest heel turn in wrestling history? Hulk Hogan or Shawn Michaels? Buy on Hogan. Hogan as the third man in the NWO is the greatest heel turn of all time. Now, when you say Shawn Michaels, I don't know if you're talking about the barbershop incident or when he super kicked Hogan in the face on Raw. I'm not sure which one, but the barbershop one would be pretty high up on my list, too. I don't know if it would be number two or not. It'd be pretty high up there, though. But none bigger than the Hogan one in 96. That's easily the best one. So that's your mailbag questions. A lot of good stuff this week. So keep emailing me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. And what I wanted to do here on this final show of the year, this is episode 475. I thought we'd do a little This Week in Sound Off History. We used to have a segment on the show called This Week in History, which had to come to an end. I loved doing it. You guys loved it, but it had to come to an end because, you know, after a year, you're going to start repeating the same things over and over again. So this is kind of a little spin-off of that. This Week in Sound Off History. And so I thought with this being episode 475, we would take a very quick look back here at what was going on episode 75. First, we'll start with that one. Episode 75 from way back on July 9th, 2009. Episode 75, if you are a longtime listener of this show, you know episode 75 very well. It is an infamous show. I know it's still a favorite for a lot of you guys. It was also a very short show. It was only 20 minutes. A lot shorter than this one, I'll tell you that much. That was my rant on the death of Michael Jackson and the ridiculous media coverage of all the events that surrounded it. I am sorry to say that the media has only gotten worse since then, not better. Episode 175 was on August 21st, 2011. Featured my take, and this is ironic, coming on this show with what I said earlier about Broken Matt. This podcast featured my take on the fall of Matt Hardy. And it's something to really reflect on when you really consider this career resurgence that he's been having. Matt was just a total mess by this point. He had just been arrested for DUI. TNA then fired him. And he's come a long way in the last 6 years. And also on the show, I talked about the creation of a machine that mutes annoying television personalities, which sadly still has not been perfected after all of these years. Boy, that could be useful right now. Sound Off 275 It was on May 26th, 2013. I talked about why Daniel Bryan, I thought, was poised to be WWE's next big breakout star. Not a bad call. It also had my NXT review. I discussed the debut of some guy named Sami Zayn. And finally, Sound Off 375 from March 28th, 2015. That was our WrestleMania roundtable from San Jose, previewing WrestleMania 31. That was the show that I did a few days after my father died. I can't tell you how great Noah and Brian were that weekend. They really helped me take my mind off things, and I appreciate the hell out of them for that. Tomorrow, as I record this on Christmas Day, tomorrow is my dad's birthday. He would have been 59. So that was This Week in Sound Off History. If you guys like that and got a kick out of it, maybe I'll do it more often here on the show. As I mentioned at the top of the podcast, we have started our fourth annual Royal Rumble pool in the Facebook group, or I should say Zach House of Pain Hulker, that is. He started it. Zach has been in charge of the pool for each of the last 4 years. He has done a fantastic job with it. Our first year, we had a total of 5 pools with 150 people taking part, and then we expanded that the next year to 15 pools and 450 people. And by last year, we had 23 pools with almost 700 people participating. So we want this to be the biggest one yet. And how you enter is very easy. If you are already a member of our private group on Facebook, you'll see Zach's post sticky to the top of the page. Now, when this podcast goes up, I'm going to sticky the podcast. So you probably won't see the pool. Hopefully, though, it'll be bumped, so it'll be near the top. But after a couple of days, I'm going to sticky it again. So don't worry. If you don't see it, it is in there. You can search for it, but I will sticky it during the week. And all you got to do is like that post. It's a post from Zach. It has all the rules and everything in there. All you got to do is like the post. You don't even have to write anything in there. You don't have to leave a comment saying, I'm in. I mean, you can if you want to, but you don't have to. Just like that post and you are officially entered. And the way it works is you're going to be added to a pool with 29 other people. When that pool gets full, it spills over into a second one and so on and so forth. And Zach will reveal everyone's numbers when we get closer to the pay-per-view. And the way it works is, let's say you draw number 25 in the pool. Whoever enters the Royal Rumble at number 25 is your pick. You want that person to win the match, right? So if that person wins, let's say my idea comes to fruition and Sami Zayn comes out at number 25 in the Royal Rumble and you have 25 in the pool, you win that pool. And what happens then is you are then entered into the ultimate pool at the very end with everybody else who also got number 25 randomly assigned to them. And then we're going to pick one final random winner from that last pool to win the entire thing. And like I said earlier, I'll buy that person a Sound Off shirt of their choosing from our store on Pro Wrestling Tees, and I'll give you a shout out on the podcast as well, so you get a little something out of this. If you are not currently a member of the Facebook group, you will need to join. And you will need to be approved by me. So just search for the group, type in the full name of the podcast in the little search bar on Facebook, and it should come up. I think our official, our little icon in there is like a fist or something. So anyway, you'll find the group. You have to apply, and you go into a queue, and at that point, I will have to approve you. What I would do, just a word to the wise here, because we literally have 3,500 people waiting in queue. Some of it is spam, some of it is people who I don't want in the group. And there are a lot of good people who unfortunately are kind of mixed in there. It's very slow in terms of getting approved. My advice to you is, if you want to be part of this thing, if you apply this week to enter the group, what you should do then is drop me a note. After you apply, drop me a note either through Facebook or send me a tweet and let me know that you just applied, and then I can go in there and approve you. So, yeah, get in on that. It's a lot of fun. I participate every year. I have yet to win. If I did win, by the way, for those of you who must be wondering, well, what happens if you win? Do you buy yourself a shirt? No. I will... I think the way it works, I haven't talked to Zach about this, but if I win, we would do something where we'd then pick another winner, and then that person would win the shout-out in the shirt. So, Even though I do play along with everybody here, we're trying to keep this on the up and up. So, also, follow me on Twitter, at Solomonster is my handle on there. Don't forget to nominate the Sound Off in the Wrestling Radio Awards. Go to WrestlingRadioAwards.com, under where it says Show of the Year. Type in Solomonster Sounds Off and click Submit. Then go back to the form and go to the category that says Best Male Interview of the Year. And if you would be so kind, type in Bob Holly on Solomonster Sounds Off. Click Submit, and we'll see what happens. Again, this is just the nominating process. Once all the nominees are sorted out, then the actual voting in the awards begins. We've won Show of the Year the last 2 years, so it'd be kind of cool to three-peat if we can pull that off this year. So that's going to wrap up the Christmas show, or I guess the Christmas slash Hanukkah show, the holiday show. We'll call it the holiday show, because there are so many of them for this year. Our final podcast of 2016, when I am back, it will be the first day of 2017, right? I think next Sunday is January 1st, and that will be Sound Off episode 476. I'm thinking that that show will probably have predictions for 2017. I usually do predictions, so we'll probably do that on the next podcast. And I just want to take a moment here at the very end. This is now officially the longest Sound Off I have ever recorded. This is the first 3-hour-plus show I've ever done. I didn't expect it to go this long, but I knew I had a lot planned. I should have seen this coming. So it's not going to be this way every week. So I figure, you know, for those of you who are off for the holidays, you need something to do. Now you got plenty of audio, right? You got plenty of... Although if you've reached this point in the show, I guess you're done. But I have enjoyed the hell out of it this year. This has been our biggest and best year yet. It's very cool for me to see the show get bigger and grow and not go backwards. We're going into our 10th year now. And that's a long time to be doing a podcast. There aren't too many out there that have been doing it longer. There are a few, and you know, Don Tony and some others have been doing this even longer, but I've enjoyed the hell out of it. I enjoy hearing from you guys, getting your feedback on always how to improve the show and make it better. And it's very cool when people go in iTunes or on Stitcher, and to get the 5-star rating, but also to read some of the reviews and some of the feedback and the compliments and stuff. We are a 5-star rated podcast on there. It's that kind of thing that makes it worthwhile for me to keep doing this. It is a huge drain on my time, just in terms of how I prep and then the actual recording on the weekends. And I've given up half of my life, you know, week to week to do the show. But I wouldn't have it any other way, because I just enjoy it. And if it ever suddenly became too much of a chore or it wasn't fun, then I wouldn't do it. But as long as you guys seem to be enjoying it and I'm enjoying myself, and to see the success of the show, whether it's using an Audible link or buying a t-shirt or making a PayPal donation, and it really is very cool. And I'm very grateful for it. I want to take a moment here to wish everybody a Merry Christmas, a Happy Hanukkah, and also a Happy New Year. I'm sure I'll wish it to you again next week. But all the best. This has been a challenging year for me, personally. I mean, on a professional level or a podcast level, it's been great. But you guys know, you know, what me and my family have been through the last, really 2 years. But this has not been the best year. My mom, for those who are asking, is, you know, chugging along. She's doing okay. I wouldn't say great. But she's chugging along, and so am I. You know, things are fine. But here's to hoping that 2017 leads to much bigger and better things for my family and for yours. Until next weekend, I shall see you all next year. Be well, stay safe, enjoy the holiday, and we'll see you back in 2017 for more Sound Off. Until then, happy holidays, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster Sounds Off.
This Impact show has moved so many times. It's got more fucking moves than Bruno Mars, this show does. Don't believe me, just watch. Impact started out on Friday, then moved to Saturday, Thursday, then they moved it to Monday. They got slaughtered, so they moved it back to Thursday, then they moved it to Wednesday, Friday again, then back to Wednesday, Tuesday, and now back to Thursday. It's like the Big Show of TV shows. It's turned 1,000 times already, and the only time people pay any attention to it is when it makes them laugh.
Monster Sounds Off. Since 2007, The Solomonster Sounds Off.
Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solo Monsters, sound off.